And hello everybody, my name is Adrian Crenshaw and welcome to the Antiquarians class, or as I like to call it, occult computing, which I'll explain why precisely I like to call it occult computing in a second. But before I continue, there's one thing I do, one order of business I want to take care of. Podge, would you be so kind to switch to the camera that's facing me?
It is.
It is? Alright, this is something I need to take care of before we start.
Well, I'm sorry.
All right, anybody that laughed, I was going to kick out, but you laughed for reasons I don't think involve what this is.
Yep.
But I'm sure the people that see this on the internet later on will laugh their butts off. That's not the kind of people I'm trying to help with this presentation.
Correct.
Do you recognize what...
I think I went to a presentation a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead and face it back down towards me. But we're going to go ahead and continue with the presentation. And parts of this is going to be live demos, and live demos have a tendency to be the bane of my existence, getting everything to function the way it's supposed to. Podge, if you'd be so kind as to switch to the computer. Good. As I said before, my name is Aiden Crenshaw. I run a website called irongeek.com. I have an interest in InfoSec education. That's kind of my future career goals. That lovely picture of me was taken by Ben at the last Louisville InfoSec, which is coming up. Sorry, the last Louisville. It was taken at the last Louisville InfoSec, which we have no one coming up in October. I don't know everything. I'm just a geek with extra time on my hands. A lot of this computer forensics stuff is actually fairly new to me. There's stuff I've learned about file systems that I didn't know 2 months ago. So double check anything I say, and you know, your mileage may vary. But if you have any questions during the presentation, just go ahead and ask. Alright, why did I use the term occult computing earlier? Well, first of all, I'm not talking about any kind of supernatural BS. Occult comes from the Latin word occultus, as in clandestine, hidden, secret, referring to hidden knowledge. Forensics relates to using science in the court of law. Well, since the things people are trying to hide, the term occult seems like a decent name, but they're not necessarily trying to hide it from law enforcement. So for anti-forensics is not necessarily always the correct terminology. Is it truly anti-forensics if you're just trying to hide something from your boyfriend or girlfriend? Probably not. So I decided to call some of this stuff occult computing just because I think it's a more appropriate name. Not to mention occult computing sounds cooler than anti-forensics. Is it still on the computer? Just leave it on the computer for most of it. It'd probably be more interesting in my face. Alright, what's this class going to be about? First of all, it's not going to be about hiding a stash from the fuzz. It can be used for that, but that's not necessarily its central focus. Law enforcement and policy enforcement people might have an interest in it to know how people hide their activities, but there's also places in the world, and even places in the United States, where you have overly invasive law enforcement and policy enforcement people, and you might be interested in how things are hidden. Not to mention, depending on what company you work for, sometimes IT people look at things they have no business doing. Sometimes, just because someone is in IT and supposedly a professional, doesn't mean they don't snoop in other people's business that they shouldn't. So some of the techniques here I think are completely ethically usable in those circumstances. For instance, you have to check your bank account. That's considered at work. Sometimes that's considered incidental use. That is perfectly within corporate policy, but obviously you don't want some IT guy coming along later on and finding your PIN number just because you happen to say leave it inside the registry someplace or leave it in the autocomplete in IE or Firefox. And of course, companies might be interested in some of this information to know how to properly clear their boxes before they donate them. A lot of people do some really destructive things to their hardware, and I'd rather see people donate the computers down the line to someone else who might need them rather than totally shred the equipment. As you can tell from the assortment of crap I keep around here, I hate to see any still functioning electronic equipment get thrown out. Okay, so what are we going to cover? Mostly we're going to be talking about Windows. Some of the ideas are going to be applicable as well to Linux and OS X, but I've done most of my testing on Windows, and specifically I've done most of my testing in Windows Vista and Windows 7. I'm not going to cover malware analysis. When I was originally asking people for what they said I should cover when I was going to an anti-forensics class, a lot of people started talking about different packer techniques. Not hacker, but packer. as in something that takes EXE and mangles it, makes it smaller, or in some cases, just changes it enough to where malware analysis can't tell what it is. That is technically anti-forensics, but it's not the kind of anti-forensics I will be covering. If I do a class in the future on malware analysis, then that topic will definitely come into play, but not so much in this particular lecture. Mostly, we'll be covering up, talking about how people can go about covering their tracks on semi-permanent storage media, flash drives, thumb drives, normal hard drives, and so forth. And there's one little piece I need to find real quick. Okay, I have a little side note here. Now, I'm going to break most of these anti-forensics techniques into four different categories. The first one is don't leave tracks in the first place. And quite frankly, this is going to be one of the easiest, most thorough ways of going about things, and it's the first one I normally would recommend. The second is selective file removal and encryption tools, as in just selectively saying, this particular file I want to completely wipe from my hard drive, or this particular file I want to delete. But quite frankly, that's a losing battle, and I'm going to try to visually demonstrate shortly why that's a losing battle. The third category I count as politricks. These are things people tell you to do online, but they don't really work. They're certain silliness, like the people who talk about, well, I'm going to hook a thermite canister above my hard drive so if the cops raid me, I can hit a switch and instantly burn up my hard drive. That kind of thing. Along with also some stuff like alternative DNS and other odds and ends. Alternative data streams and other odds and ends that can be useful from time to time, but in general, aren't that handy.
That only works on programs like Mission Impossible, where after they get you talking, everything burns up, right?
In those circumstances, yeah, I suppose. I'll explain why I don't think of it as a particularly useful technique
only
in a bit.
Only in Hollywood.
Then finally, nuke it from orbit is the only way to be sure. Anybody here a James Cameron fan? By the way, I'm going to be making various geek jokes throughout the entire thing to gauge my audience. You'll find plenty of little pop culture references throughout here. Here's my little Venn diagram of Doom, trying to place where I put different anti-forensics techniques. From, you know, weak, technical, convenient, comprehensive, and secure. The stuff like deleting a file. Everybody here is familiar with the fact that if you just delete a file, it's still on the hard drive.
Right.
Well, that falls in the category of convenient, because most everybody can just delete a file, though I have people I work with that don't seem to be able to, and weak. There's other things you could do, let's say like selective file wiping and encryption. That's fairly convenient if you use the right tools, and it's somewhat secure. But for some reasons I'm going to show later on, even selective file wiping ends up leaving traces all over the hard drive, for reasons I'll cover here in a bit. In the comprehensive section, anything that's usually comprehensive, convenient, and secure, it's generally going to be somewhat technical. Like a full hard drive encryption, it's gotten a lot easier now with the advent of BitLocker and TrueCrypt system for doing it, which I might demonstrate later. It's pretty simple to handle. But not everybody has an easy handle on it. And then there's things like Stego, which isn't comprehensive. It's definitely technical, and it's only as secure as if someone doesn't know about it. But it's so inconvenient, I don't see people using it. A lot of things I put in the politics section are things that they might actually work okay, they might be secure, but there's so much more trouble what they give you versus just completely encrypting your hard drive, there's no real point in considering them. Okay, background info. These are odds and ends. I didn't know where else to stick, but I figured I should explain the topic before I continue because I'm going to be referring back to these concepts throughout the presentation. One of the first things I'm going to mention is a few interesting legal events. And first of all, I am not a lawyer in no way. However, I did run these by someone who is a lawyer, but not my lawyer. So any mistakes? A guy that goes by the name Trip at the conferences, Tyler, I mentioned him later on in the presentation as well, had him overlook some of this information for me. And the best as I understand it, what I'm saying is going to be correct, but your mileage may vary, and once again, I am not a lawyer. Some interesting cases, though, to look at after this presentation is over with. Check out the Julia Mero case. Has anybody heard of this lady? All right, quick rundown of what happened to this lady. She's a school teacher, and I've seen interviews of her. Sure, nice enough lady, but really not very computer literate. She was in class, and she started getting porn pop-ups all over the place in her class. This was, like, I believe, in around 2004, and it was still running Windows 98 with out-of-date antivirus package. Well, she went to one of the supervisors and told him about it, but nothing really came of it. A little while later, they come at her with endangerment of a child's morals charges. And they started to say, well, you deliberately showed this porn to these people, to these children. Not really. And if you read up on the investigator who was working for the prosecutor, it was clear that he had no idea. Like, he'd say things like, he didn't check for malware on the system. He didn't seem to understand what a... Who has ever had a porn pop-up store? How many people here are liars? it was more common in the late 90s, to tell you the truth. By the way, anybody who came in late, if you want a CPE, just go ahead and fill out the sheet over there. But anyway, she got in huge trouble, and even after it was demonstrated that, actually, it was screw-ups on multiple levels. The people who was the defense forensics examiner didn't exactly do things quite right either, as far as, I believe it was some along the lines of getting the evidence in on time to where the prosecution could look at it. And anyway, ultimately, she ended up getting charged $100 and getting her teacher's license revoked, all because some porn popped up on a machine that she couldn't control, and she'd always probably been told not to just shut the machine down, so it was up and running. And she tried to shoo the kids away from it, but she got in huge trouble, and the prosecutor, once they, I guess they just didn't want to have a loss on their record or look silly later on for prosecuting a woman who they really shouldn't have. Now, on the opposite side of things, you also should look up the Sebastian Bacher. I'm not even pronouncing his last name right. You might want to look up his case. Who else heard of Sebastian Bacher? All right. Who else heard about the guy who came across the Canadian border, had child porn on his laptop, then when they went to investigate later, they found it was encrypted? Someone might want to help that gentleman. Okay, here's basically what happened to him. He was coming back across the Canadian border, and the border agents basically seized his laptop, and they started looking at it, and at the time, he was using, I believe, PGP disk encryption. They were able to find child porn on it. Well, they were going to charge him with that. They shut the machine down, did a forensics image of it, but it was encrypted. Later on, in a court, they said, well, give us the password so we can decrypt the contents. At that point, he invoked his Fifth Amendment rights, basically to self-incrimination, and said that I don't have to give that to you. There was a lot of legal wrangling, and to my knowledge, I don't think it's still completely settled. Initially, a judge said that since it's a product of the mind, the password is, he didn't have to surrender it. But later on, there was some bill set that basically went along the lines of, okay, we'll give you immunity for providing your password, because we'll say the password doesn't prove it was your laptop, but we have other ways of proving it was your laptop. So ultimately, you have no Fifth Amendment protections against it. It's really subtle, and I can't say, as a non-lawyer, I understand it. But Sebastian Bacher, definitely look up his case. Basically, what it comes down to, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later on, it's much easier for a court to order someone to surrender a hardware dongle or USB key or something physical than it is to get the court to demand delivery of something that's in someone's mind. It's kind of like the analogy people use sometimes is asking for a physical key versus asking for a combination. Just keep that in mind. Another thing you might want to be interested in is the hacker defense. Some people in the past, and Julia Mero, for instance, she actually seemed to legitimately have the Trojan defense or hacker defense that she could pull out, basically claiming, it wasn't me that did it to my machine, someone else did it to my machine. it was some kind of Trojan on my box, some kind of spyware that caused the child porn or whatever to get downloaded, or that caused my machine to attack someone else's machine. It's not my fault. Sometimes the hacker defense works, sometimes it doesn't. There's certain legal problems with getting this defense to work. Julia Mayer had no problem because, well, she had problems regardless, but this defense worked better for her than it would, let's say, for me. I'm pretty obviously a computer geek. I run a computer geek website. I go to computer geek conferences. I have a harder time mounting this particular defense than Julia Mayer did. Anybody that's in this particular class will probably have a harder time mounting this defense than Julia Mayer did. Your sweet little grandmother, though, she might be able to. That said, you really can't say that you, even a fairly experienced computer geek can't use the hacker defense legitimately because who all heard about Dan Kaminsky getting hacked a while back? Dan Kaminsky is a fairly well-known computer security researcher, and even he got his box and passwords compromised. It happens even to people who are, you know, really technically competent. So another term I'm going to be using throughout the presentation is a spoilation. Basically, someone screws up the evidence. If the defendant does it, it's bad for the defendant. If the prosecution does it, it's good for the defendant. One example of, I suppose, spoilation might be if someone knows they're about to get investigated for a crime, and then all of a sudden they wipe the hard drive at that point. That's a huge legal issue there. First of all, it's destruction of evidence. Not to mention, my understanding, courts can find that essentially tell the jury, all right, since they went to destroy evidence, obviously there must have been something there, so go ahead and consider it to have been there. Which, what? Yeah, that it's...
Well, Bush did the same thing.
It regardless, it's generally, I'll go into a little bit of that about writing down policy if you're going to wipe your drives and why you don't want to do it just before an investigation. Also, who here has ever heard the CSI effect? Essentially, CSI has caused people in the public to think that science can give answers that it may not necessarily be able to, and they have totally different expectations of courtroom evidence than what might be realistic. And this causes some complications with modern juries, so my understanding goes. But Wikipedia has an interesting entry on that. And another thing to check out from a legal standpoint is some people at Nomad's Mobile Research Center. Anybody ever been to their website? It's a good resource, and they have something called... they did a presentation at DEF CON, you can actually download the video of it, where they talk about developing a plausible deniability toolkit, and essentially it's to help people be able to mount the hacker defense. Basically doing things to your machine to make it plausible that someone else actually did the crime and not you. Now I'm also going to be covering some of the tech stuff before we get on into the more live parts of the presentation. It's hard to cover these things in order because some topics are so interrelated, it's hard to know what to cover first. You need to understand some things before you understand other things, but I'm not sure what order to put these in. Also, one of the things I'm going to show you is just to put across in your head that Windows jams data in all sorts of places, and there are tools to make it fairly easy to recover. You may think you deleted your history, but did you really delete your history? And I'm going to cover some tech stuff that help illustrate that. But a little bit about terminology. Now, for this class, I'm going to be using a flash drive for most of my storage needs as far as recovering files. However, if you're talking about a disk, they usually break them down into tracks, which you see as the red track on the disk, geometric sectors, track sectors, and clusters. We're mostly going to be talking about sectors and clusters. Sectors is how the disk is actually broken down. And generally on any modern hardware, that's going to be, each sector is going to be 512 bytes long. A cluster is how the operating system, or I should say the file system, addresses it. Essentially, a cluster is made out of so many sectors. I believe by default, if your sectors are 512 bytes, I believe NTFS by default, at least when I was formatting this flash drive a second ago, it set the clusters at 4 kilobytes. So by multiplying that out, you'll see those 8 sectors to each one of those clusters. Mm. The reason it addresses by clusters and says sectors is you can address all of these as one particular offset, whereas the sectors, you'd have to keep records of a lot more spots. So what it'll say is, all of these sectors are in this particular cluster. You all know, are familiar with FAT12, FAT16, and FAT32. The 32 in there, or the 16 or the 12, refers to the number of bits set aside for keeping track of which cluster you're on. Now, the reason someone might want a small cluster size is that they have less wasted disk space, which I'll cover up in a second. The reason they might want a larger one is to have less file fragmentation. There's something called slack space. Has anybody heard of slack space before? All right, slack space is essentially the area that is beyond the end of the file, but up to the end of the cluster that's on. For instance, let's say I have a cluster size of 4 kilobytes, but the file I want to put there only takes up 2 kilobytes. Well, I have a whole 2 sectors of slack space there, the space I'm not using. Well, the way modern drives generally work, when you write something to it, it ends up writing the file, and here you see file 2, and all the way up to the end of the sector, after it's finished writing its file, all the way to the beginning of the very next sector here, this is called RAM slack. The reason it's called RAM slack is historically what used to happen is some stuff in RAM would get jammed in there to fill out the rest of the file. On modern operating systems, I think like Windows 2000 and after perhaps, it's all just nulled out. Then you have residual slack. This is the rest of the cluster. This goes back to what I was saying before about why you want a small cluster size versus a large cluster size. If you have a large cluster size, you don't have to fragment the file as much, because you can put the entire file in one continuous cluster. As opposed to, I have this cluster free, so I write part of the file here, part of the file here, part of the file here. The reason you know what fragmentation is, it takes longer, at least on a spinning disk. On flash drives, it really doesn't matter. On a spinning disk, it takes longer to read this one, and this one, than it would if all the data was continuous. The problem with having a large cluster size is this extra slack space is completely wasted that you can't address or use. Well, that's not quite true. There's tools for addressing and using it and hiding data in there. Mm. But the thing to remember about slack space is sometimes there's remnant data in there. Like for instance, at this location, at one time, I had a file called file 1 that was much longer than file 2. However, when I deleted it and then wrote file 2 down, it didn't overwrite all of file 1. Some remnant of it was still there in slack space. And it's possible for someone to go back in and pull that data out. And I'm going to be showing some tools for automating that and doing just that. We're not going to talk much about RAM slack. Also, RAM slack is also apparently sometimes referred to as sector slack. But it actually is overwritten. It's the stuff from the end of the last used sector to the end of the cluster that remains and might contain useful data. Who all here is familiar with different hashing algorithms? Okay, just as a review for people who aren't. Essentially, a hash is a one-way function that takes some string of characters and turns it into a smaller string of characters. The point being that it's something smaller you can store and look up later on. You might use it for database functionality, or in computer security, it's sometimes used for storing passwords, so you don't have to put the plain text password out there. You put a hash of the plain text password where people can't easily reverse it and find the original password, or fingerprinting files. We're going to use some later on for fingerprinting files. One popular hashing algorithm is MD5. Another one is SHA. And there's a couple different varieties of SHA, if I'm not mistaken. Another bit of technical information I'd like to provide to everybody is whenever you've used a hard drive partitioning tool, if you use the right one, have you seen a section that was set aside for like a system rebuild partition or utilities partition? Some computer vendors will use either host protected areas or a disk configuration overlay to set aside part of the disk that the BIOS's normal functionality and operating system's normal functionality can't see. It's potentially possible for a person trying to hide data to jam stuff in these areas, Though I'm not going to cover that in depth at all because so far I haven't found any good convenient tools for doing such a thing. One thing you might be interested in is forensically interesting spots in the registry. And I think I have a demo coming up here very shortly. Yes. At this particular URL, I have a whole list of forensically interesting spots where you can pull out data from a system. Let me actually bring up that file. If you go underneath sample data on the computer, on the download I gave everybody, there's a little Word doc there. There's all sorts of... Must be because of an update I did recently. I did not tell you to do that. Alright, here's a few interesting spots in the registry and some of the data people can pluck out of it. You have your recent documents and so forth. You have network shortcuts. This could tell someone who is interested in someone's internal IT structure, like what service they use. A lot of people think of forensics as just being for someone trying to investigate policy misuse or someone trying to investigate some kind of a criminal case. However, if you're a pen tester and you happen to be able to come across someone's laptop, there's all sorts of useful information you can find out about someone's internal network structure. Stuff that was typed into the run bar can be stored in this particular registry key. Just a whole list of different places where Windows jams data. That's one of the things I was talking about before about selective file wiping, why it's not necessarily the best idea. There's so many different places that Windows makes temporary files or where it tracks changes or where it says, at some point in time, this person opened this particular file. That's sort of a losing case to try to selectively write these records. And to give you a better idea of some of these, what I'm going to do is, let me... Where's it at? There we go. I need to go ahead and start up my Vista VM. I'm going to show you some tools you can use to recover some of this data. You can go directly to those registry keys if you really, really want to, but quite frankly, that can be a pain, and sometimes the data is stored in a semi-obfuscated manner. Sometimes Microsoft does something as silly as ROC 13. I personally have encrypted my entire presentation with ROC 26.
I thought it was funny. I'm wondering for the punchline.
Okay. Anyway, ROC 13 is essentially... You increment the characters of the alphabet 13 places. Then if you write 13 again, you unencrypt it, essentially.
Right.
26 characters in the alphabet. So ROC 26 is not encrypted at all. It's the same as double XOR encryption. I'm waiting for this machine to come up. And it's still on the computer, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Because I'm going to show you some of the tools that I've... But to show you. The first one's actually inside of, let me see, if I can remember which password I assigned myself for this VM. For obvious reasons, I didn't want to actually show real data on my own laptop of my recent activities because I've embarrassed myself at presentations before doing that. You really don't want to know. Work. No filtering. Alright, anybody who actually downloaded that pack I sent out to folks in email, go underneath track covering and clean after me.
Oh, okay.
Now, the reason I use this is actually a tool for wiping all sorts of registry and file system entries. If you decide to use it later on, an option you'll definitely want to go in and use, go underneath advanced options, and you have the option to say overwrite with 0 bytes. As I showed before with this file slack example, you're just deleting the file doesn't actually get the data off the hard drive. this will. Now, I know some people are probably thinking, well, unless you overwrite it 35 times, like Gutman said back in the late 90s, you can still get it. No, you really can't. I'll cover that later on. One white with all zeros, it's toast. And even back in Gutman's day, actually, I'll almost save that rant for a little bit later in the presentation. And don't worry, guys, in about 10 minutes, I'll give everybody a break. But one cool thing I like about Nearsoft's Clean After Me is you can pull up something, and like, for instance, here in recent files, I can clean it, but I can also say open it, so it shows me what's there. Well, here you see I have a bunch of links to some pictures I opened up, some text documents I opened up, and a folder I opened up. Knowing this kind of information, you can tell what a person's been looking at recently. For a forensics investigator, that's useful stuff. Network places, I don't think has anything interesting in it. The run bar, what commands has this person been running at the run bar? Well, apparently they've been running Notepad. But that's about the only thing I've ran. By the way, some of you should note, and I've ran across this, and I go into it in my article on interesting spots in the Windows 7 registry. If you do a start, alright, I have my Visto tweaked out differently. By default, you don't normally have the run bar anymore, you have this little search bar. Running commands on that doesn't get stored in that particular registry key. I'm not sure where it is stored. Surely someplace, but I'm not quite sure yet. There's stuff inside a user assist, which I don't have here, but I have a description for that in my notes page. Recycle bin, last logged in username. Now, by the way, the way I'm doing this right now, it would not be forensically sound. An actual forensics investigator would take the drive, put a write protector on it, suck the entire drive off, use something along the lines of, set the whole drive off using DD or FTK Imager or whatever InCase calls their particular tool, then pluck the stuff they need out of that. Those tools like RegRipper that's free for basically pulling stuff out of the registry, and file system, there's all sorts of tools for just mounting that big block device, that big file, as if it's a hard drive, but in read-only mode, and just plucking the files you need off of it. What's that?
Boot blocker.
See, I'd like to be able to review some hardware blockers, but egads are just too...
Yeah, $1,000 or something.
Well, here's the deal. I found this when I was trying to order barcode scanners. The electronics really aren't that difficult, all things considered, but it comes down to supply and demand and how many people need to order it. And the people that need to order it really need to order it, but there's not enough people ordering it to get that whole...
Right.
What's the term? Volumes of scale?
Right.
That's a large part of the problem. Let me see. Event log. There's tons of different types of information. Last 20 type URLs in Internet Explorer. I typed in Google. Unfortunately, this VM is fairly clean, so you're not seeing a lot of data. Firefox history, but I can't open that. But let me show you some other tools. Clean After Me will show you some stuff, and it'll also clean some stuff. But let's look at some more interesting tools for recovering stuff. All this stuff is ultimately stored in the registry or files, but knowing which file to go to is a bear. Some tools I'm going to show, like I said, aren't completely forensically sound, but if someone's just interested in poking around your data later on, they're easy enough to use. Nearsoft makes a lot of really cool tools for plucking stuff out of files. For instance, there's My Last Search, which if you go underneath that directory I gave you, that aft.zip file, if you extracted it, inside of bin, there's a directory called My Last Search. There's a file called My Last Search. What this does is it looks where Internet Explorer, Firefox, and I'm thinking maybe Google Chrome keep the records of URLs they've been to. And it will automatically parse them and look for search terms. For instance, here's some search terms I've apparently typed in. Albino midget Nazi Eskimo porn. How to kill a messy roommate and get away with it. And apparently I have a thing for lolcats and naughty Linux girls in trouble. And Terminator Sarah Connor Rule 34.
Yes.
Unfortunately, they canceled that show. But My Last Search, instead of actually having to go into those individual registry keys or individual files to recover that stuff, Nears made an awesome little tool that automatically gathered the information for me. tools like InCase and so forth that professionals use would also have them. But unfortunately, InCase, I'd love to play with it, but they don't really have a demo version I could download. Unless I'm wrong and someone can find it for me. I didn't see it. So I haven't got a chance to play with those. But Neo makes plenty of tools if you're not interested in doing it forensically soundly to recover this kind of information. There's also a lot of other tools that are made. If you're interested in just the Windows history, Pasco is good, but I don't think I have enough, and I went ahead and included it in my download. I don't think it's a command line tool. So when you ran yours, it just did that, right? That's because that's a command line tool. You have to go out to the command line to actually run it, and it will bring up internet history out of the index.dat file.
I can ask you a question.
Yes.
I purchased my business about 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I save a lot of documents that I read later on. Some of them from the government, of course, FBI. And some of them's like 150 pages long, and I'm eventually getting around to reading them. Well, I need, you know, I go back in and deleted it, but they're still there.
Where are they at, though? You said you deleted them.
I don't know. You asked.
Did you delete them from your email, or did you delete them from the file system on the computer?
They were, I forgot what type of file I was. Oh, gee,
I'd have to see it to have more information.
Okay.
But I'm not really sure.
No, it was not an email, I can tell you that. It was some type of file.
Alright, but Pasco is one way of looking at index.dat. I think I have a little easier tool. If you go underneath Deft Extra, who has ever heard of Helix? Helix is a forensics CD. It has two sides to it. One side has a bunch of Windows tools, and one side is essentially a bootable Linux distribution that you can do all sorts of things like image your hard drive, look for picture images. In this case, it'd be a different type of image. Unfortunately, they went commercial and stopped developing it, but luckily a few other groups have started developing their own little forensic CD. One of them is the Deft Group, and they have the whole little Linux live CD. But they also package up on that same live CD a set of tools and a nice little Windows GUI for doing your live forensics. Live forensics is essentially where the machine is still up and running, and you want to grab data that way. There's also stuff you're sometimes shutting off a machine, you actually lose data, like what network connections are going on, who's connected at that exact moment, different odds and ends like that, what processes are running at that moment, things you might want to know. So sometimes it's better to leave a machine on and actually do live forensics. However, anytime you do any kind of live forensics, you're changing the machine ultimately. And that comes into some other legal questions. If you're really worried about changing the machine, yet you want to be able to do some semi-live forensics, your best bet, if the machine is set up to do hibernate, you can make the machine hibernate. It'll write that out to a hibernation file on the hard drive, and it's possible with the right tools, you can look at that hibernation file and figure out what was going on when the system was shut down. Maybe. But regardless, Deft Linux comes with a bunch of different tools, and for those that didn't see where I went to get into that, it was underneath AFT, Anti-Forensics Tools is what that directory stands for, Deft Extra. And I ran the little Deft GUI, and I want to go in and show some stuff in the web browser section. Oh, another thing it has, and I don't want to show this, Neosoft makes a ton of tools for recovering passwords. Like if you ever store your password in Firefox or Internet Explorer, it's super easy to recover that. New versions of Firefox, I've had some problems with Neo's tools. That might be because they switched to how they're storing them around. But most of these things work really well. Wireless keys. If you're ever on a laptop that you've configured to connect to your wireless network, but you forgot your WEP or WPA key, you can use Wireless Key View to see what it was, which is really nifty. But just in case I didn't sanitize that data on this machine, I don't really want to show that. However, web browsers, this I'll show. Here's IE History View. Here's a few of the things I've searched for. You see I've gone to Google and I did that search for Sarah Connor Chronicles, Rule 34. You see that albino midget Nazi Eskimo porn again. You know, I have completely normal tastes. You see a couple of files I've accessed. and details like that. Like I said, this could all be gotten manually by either looking at the right spots in the file system or the registry, but this is just so much simpler. Cookie view, here's all these different cookies. Oh, that's another thing I want to say about Windows storing stuff in all sorts of places. If you're interested in someone's internet history, well, you have the history file itself, which is going to have the complete URL, but you also have the cookies. If you look at the cookies and you see that the person has a cookie from google.com, well, then pretty obviously at some point in time they visited google.com. They also have tools for looking at Chrome's information. Oh, Mozilla Cache View. Alright, when it comes to Internet Explorer, their cache is pretty much stored in the clear as far as what it looks like. Neither one encrypts it. But in Internet Explorer's case, if you actually go through the file path, and I have it listed in that little text file I gave everybody, well, I should say Word doc I gave everybody, you can look directly, and a JPEG is a JPEG, a GIF is a GIF. In the case of Mozilla, they rename all the files, and unless you open them up, you don't know what they are. Mozilla Cache View is nice because it'll actually parse these little index files and show you what's what. And let me see, like, I'm not even sure what this one is. Open link in browser, let's see what it was. And apparently it was just some image that I happened to visit. I think that one came from slash dot. But looking through the pictures that are in someone's cache, there's all sorts of information you can find out about the web browsing history. And you can see here that there's even an index of what page it was pulled from. Like, I was looking at, everybody knows what lolcat is? I was looking at a bunch of lolcat pictures, and that's all recorded in here as well. Once again, this section of the class is just to show that there's so much information you can pull up about somebody just based on what's been left in the registry. And at that note, let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break and come back in, because I see a few people kind of nodding off. If anybody really needs an energy drink, I guess I have plenty to spare. But yeah, let's come back in at, I got 1:59 on my watch, so let's come back at 2:10.
Leave it like it is.
Yeah, I'm going to pause it for a second.
Yeah.
Despite these remarks from the teacher, if anybody really needs caffeine, I don't think I'm going to be able to drink all this in one sitting. Well, it's the sugar content that's going to get to me.
Oh, yeah.
All right, but I think I've shown my point that there's all sorts of places that Windows stores information. So let's get down to the nitty-gritty and actually show how to cover up or keep some of this information from getting stored in the first place. One of the ways I'm going to try to do that is, well, let me switch back to my PowerPoint slides. Everybody loves my PowerPoint slides, right?
Yep.
I mentioned a couple of these tools. Nearsoft, like I said, makes a bunch of tools for automatically going in and covering all sorts of information about someone's browser activities as well as locally stored passwords and whatnot. And Def Linux also comes with some of these tools. A lot of them actually are, it took Nier's tools and repackaged them. But they have other things as well. Another nice thing about Def Linux is it comes with, FTK's Imager, which is a really nifty package for imaging a hard drive. And it's got somewhere, have you ever been on a system where you wanted to make a copy of the file, but the file was locked? It can copy that file. And if anybody's really interested, I'll show that here in a bit as well. All right. The best way, and probably the easiest in most cases, is just not to leave tracks in the first place. All sorts of modern web browsers have what's known as, Chrome calls it incognito mode, other groups call it something else. Generally, the internet slang term for it is porn mode. Firefox calls it private browsing, IE calls it in private. Chrome calls it incognito mode. Opera, so far I haven't found quite the right equivalent. Kiosk mode is similar, but not quite. On this particular slide, I list the shortcut keys for switching into a private browsing mode.
Control-Shift-P for private. And if it's possible, I also list a command line equivalent. What I've liked to do in the past is have it so that I can hit a certain shortcut on my desktop and have that browser automatically come up as incognito mode, which is really easy to do in Chrome and IE, because all you have to do is put a dash private in IE or a dash dash incognito in Chrome, and everything in that browser would be in privacy mode. Firefox, I have found that ability. You can set the option to be permanent inside of custom settings, but it's really not quite the same thing. If you want to switch into privacy mode on Chrome, or sorry, incognito mode if they call it, it's Control-Shift-N, but on IE and Firefox, it's Control-Shift-P. So I'm going to switch over to here, and let me open up Firefox. It should look the same in IE. Feel free to open it up in IE instead. If you do Control-Shift and hit down P, it says Start Private Browsing. Alright, I'm now in private browsing mode. I can go to, let's say, 4chan.org. Actually, I've already been to that place. Let me see. Think of some place that's not too awfully bad, but some place I probably haven't been. Whitehouse.com, right? Does that? Oh, it's Gov. Yes, right. That's someplace I haven't been before recently. And there I am. I'm actually going to copy that. That wasn't what I was expecting. He's a pretty man and all, but that's not... Never mind.
What about the, some of the pornography magazine?
Yeah, I know. Same thing, similar in Explorer. Control-Shift-P, say yes. And essentially the idea is that when you go someplace, it doesn't store any history, it doesn't store the cookies, it doesn't store the passwords, and so forth. So in theory, you're not leaving any tracks on the machine. Now, granted, your mileage may vary. You probably want to Google around to see how good the privacy mode is for whatever your web browser of choice is. I've heard some rumor of them leaking information that they shouldn't. But if I get back out of this, let me see, there should be some, I'm trying to see if there's an indicator on IE. I use Firefox most of the time, so I'm going to switch back to Firefox. As you can see on Firefox, up here in the URL bar, let me shrink that, you see it says private browsing. Now let's say I switched back out of private mode, which once again is just Control-Shift-P. Make sure the window's actually active. If I go up here to the history, hopefully it's not remembering whitehouse.gov. But that's essentially the way that works. The idea is that you simply aren't storing that information. Now, on the topic of private browsers, sometimes you want to remember history, you want to be able to do bookmarks, you want to be able to do passwords, but you still don't want people to easily be able to grab that data. Well, doing that from the local hard drive is problematic. Luckily, there's all sorts of portable web browsers. If you go underneath that package I gave everybody, by the way, sir, were you able to download it? Cool. If you go underneath web browsers, I have two packages there. One is Firefox Portable. This is just straight up Firefox. You run it, and it runs all from the flash drive. The nice thing about this is it's saving the history to the flash drive. It's saving the cookies to the flash drive, so that it's not leaving it on that machine, at least not in theory. There's some exceptions to that where things can leak out into the page file, which I'll be talking about some in a bit. Another option you have...
Can it still be seen by, websites
though? Yes, it will be seen. Yes, but that's where Tor comes in. There's also something called Tor Browser. Now, Tor is something you can set up independently on your machine, or you can run a Tor browser, and basically it's a package with portable Firefox and Tor and all the stuff rolled in together, along with Pigeon. Pigeon is essentially an open source AIM and Yahoo chat and IRC client. It basically rolls all the popular chat programs into one. Let me see if this actually fired up.
Interesting. What's going on there? It's still coming up. Who here is familiar with Tor? Okay, pretty much everybody. Essentially, for those who aren't though, Tor is a sense of the Onion Router. The idea is it encrypts everything on each step along the way so that no single party along the way knows both what it is that's being sent or who's sending it. So to give you an idea, I negotiate with, what was it, Potter? I'm terrible memory.
Podge.
I negotiate with Podge, a public and private key, to exchange data. Through him, I do the same with Mike, and through him, I do the same with that Mike. Well, I get keys from all these people, and I encrypt it once for you, once for him, and once for the Mike at the final end. And at that point, it's unencrypted and sent out on the internet. By doing it that way, he may know who it's coming from, but he can't read the contents. He sees it's coming from Podge, but he doesn't know the contents, and he doesn't know I'm the one sending it. Now, Mike can finally decrypt it, because he has the final key in the chain, and send it out, but the only person he knows about in the entire line is this Mike. Make sense? Kinda, sorta? Now, one problem with Tor, and for some reason at this particular library, I'm not able to pull it up. Maybe they're blocking it. I'm not sure. There's ways you can block Tor. I actually have an article on my website about that. The problem with Tor is some people think it's secure because it is encrypted. Unfortunately, when it's going out that Mike's Tor node, well, anybody can put up a Tor exit point. I've had one running at my own house before. So if you don't trust the person that's running the exit point, they could still be sniffing information. Some people have been lulled into a false sense of security and sent all sorts of private data across the Tor exit node that really wasn't trusted. There was someone who compromised like a ton of embassy passwords because someone was logging into a pop-free email
over
the Tor network. So the person like pwned a ton of people just doing that. I always thought it'd be an interesting research case to actually see what kind of data is going across Tor, whether or not it's really legitimate political dissidence kind of materials like what the EFF wants to go across it, or if it's like child pornography or something like that. But technically, it would interfere with certain wiretapping laws if you were to do that. But if someone named Bob were to do this, anybody here listen to Paul.com? Good podcast, you need to listen to it. Let's say a guy named Bob was to do it. What he would likely see is a lot of people, a few people looking at CP, child porn, a few people doing legitimate political dissident stuff, and a whole lot of people looking at adult female Asian porn. Keep in mind this, porn is, China has kind of a weird culture when it comes to pornography. And they have all sorts of very strict laws against it. So it seems that a whole lot of people using Tor using it to get to completely, to porn that would be completely legal in the United States.
Someone made an interesting point the other day talking about pornography. In the courts, we give someone who's doing killing children, 4,000 children a day, we give them no sentence in court, but give somebody doing pornography 15 years. Now, the system's messed up.
Yeah.
Somebody legalized marijuana.
I have kind of a libertarian sensibility. As long as consenting adults do whatever the hell they want, I don't care.
Neil Borg, right? I like him.
Alright, I'm going to hide this, because quite frankly, for some reason, on this network, I can't seem to connect to Tor.
You got one.
Oh, you connected to Tor, no problem? I don't need to use it, it's okay. Essentially, I've explained what Tor would do if I was able to get it working. Oh, by the way, some of you might be interested in knowing some tools to tell whether or not privacy mode is really working, and whether or not data is being written all over the place on your hard drive. How many people here have ever used Procmine before? Let me show this tool to you all.
Did you send that to us?
Yes.
Great.
Everything's in there.
I need to use that.
Alright, underneath bin, I have a tool called Procmine. The way Procmine works is it's from SysInternals. It gives you a ton of information about what different processes on your machine are doing. Now right now I just have registry stuff viewed. And for some reason, filter, reset filter.
Adrian, I have a question about Tor.
Yes, go ahead.
How does Tor compare to anonymizers?
All right, probably slower, but probably more anonymous. Ultimately, these anonymizers, if you're talking like some web proxy out there someplace, you've got to know how much do you trust the person running that anonymizer? Are they keeping track? Because ultimately, if they're keeping any kind of logs, they can tie you to that traffic. With Tor, it's going through him, it's going through him, and it's going through him. And they all pretty much have to collude to be able to figure out who I am. There's an exception to that because there's a certain profile they can do based on this Tor. If they control enough Tor nodes, both entry and exit, they can say, well, this person sent 600 bytes, and that person sent out 600 bytes, so that person must be the person coming out that end. Yeah. The statistical attacks like that they can do, I'd say it's probably more secure than your average anonymizing service online. If you want some of the security of Tor, but you want more speed, the people who've ever seen the Iron Key? The Iron Key is basically this hardware encrypted thumb drive. And I wish I had mine with me. They actually sent me one for a product review. Yeah, but the one that you get from them, they actually have their own private version of Tor that's much, much faster. There, he's got one. That's an Iron Key. But besides just being encrypted, it also acts as a security token, and also they come with their own version of Portable Firefox and their own private version of Tor. And I talked to one of the company representatives, and they said they're not logging that information, but I don't know. Regardless, it is a lot faster than the public Tor nodes. Does that more or less answer the question?
Yes, thank
you. No problem. All right, here's process monitor up and running. And you see it's doing its thing. It's showing that, for instance, this particular process is opening up this registry key. It's also showing me different files that are being edited or created or opened. It's basically showing me all the different things that these different programs are up to. But let's say, for instance, I just wanted to filter this out to one particular program. I can go to Filter, and actually, rather do it that way, I'll see if I can just find it in the list. If I can find Firefox in this list someplace.
Oh, I think you just passed.
Yes. Well, it appears there multiple times.
Yeah,
let's make it all sorts of records.
I used speed read.
I can right-click on it, and I'm going to say Include Firefox. Now it's just showing me activity that Firefox is doing. As you can see, it's reading and writing from these files. And this is sort of like a history file for Firefox. It's sending stuff in and out these ports. And if it made any kind of registry changes, you'd probably see that in here too. The nice thing about procmod is if you want to know what a system is accessing and whether or not it's leaving tracks, this might give you a good idea because it's showing you what files and what registry keys on the system it's opening and writing to and creating. The problem is, as you can see, even just with Firefox, there's a whole lot of data here. And that can be a bit annoying to parse through. However, it's very comprehensive. If you want other tools to see what a particular tool's doing, another thing that Process Monitor is great for, how many people have problems because so many people design apps poorly and require admin access to be able to run them? You pretty much end up having to give your user admin access to run some app. Well, Process Monitor can help with that because you can see where that particular problem application is writing to and then give the user just full access to those particular registry keys or those particular spots in the file system. So instead of giving them full admin access, you can give them just full rights to those particular file system paths or the registry keys. Yes, it's a big pain in the ass. But, you know, having users run as full admin all the time and owning their own boxes with a bunch of malware is also a pain. But this case is possibly a little too much information. Let's try something else. Let's try instead, I have a couple other tools in here that are like procmod, but not the exact same. There's some other tools from, in this case, Nearsoft. I'm trying to find them. One's called Reg from App. What this shows, and I can start it up to automatically watch whatever process I currently have running, but that can be a bit of a pain. The thing I like about Reg from App is I can say start a new process, I can go point it at the exe. In this case, I'm going to point it at, I'm going to close the Firefox I have open right now. And I'm going to point it at web browsers, Firefox Portable, Firefox Portable EXE, and let's see what registry keys are happening. Alright, I'm just going to, this is the first time I've ran this particular installation of Portable Firefox. If there's any registry action going on, it should show me here. However, apparently, it may not be doing anything to the registry, so that's not going to be a very interesting thing to show you. Let me show you something else.
Hey, cleaned it.
Well, it should show me any kind of writes or even reads.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you're wondering, where is this setting stored for this particular app so it comes up in this way? These tools will let you know that. Hmm. I'm going to start a different process. I'm going to start up, let's
do... It's good to know it's not running through the registry.
Was that?
It's good to know it's not running through the registry.
Apparently it's not. Let me see if I can run... Well, I don't want that would definitely do it. Okay, it wants to be pointed directly at the EXE. Alright, start a new process. Well, actually, here's one I'm probably going to show later on, but I know for sure it accesses the registry. There's something in here called, I have a directory called Selected File Wipers. And there's a tool in there called sdelete.exe. I'm going to run that. Now it ran, and this is not, this ain't cool. Start new process. Let me try that one more time. So I need to hit start tracing immediately. That's why I screwed up. Now in theory, that should have showed me what I needed to see. I'm having all sorts of difficulties, gentlemen. Start a new process.
Might be the library.
Well, I don't think in this particular case it's the library. It should be bringing up a little, Let me go back to my other original plan. This is why I said earlier that live demos are the bane of my existence. Well, I was having no problems getting Redstrum app to work from home. Regardless, very much like the other tools, it should show you what's going on as far as what things are writing to where in the registry. I keep bringing up the wrong thing. I'm going to try one last time before I give up and go on to other tools. The nice thing about this, when it does work, anybody here who's used a .reg file where you can right-click on it and say import into registry? The really nice thing about Reg from app is it outputs stuff in that format. So you can just copy and paste it out and apply the same kind of registry changes that the app is making to your system, which is pretty nifty. For whatever reason, this one is not being happy, and I'm trying to see if there's any other applications on here that would be likely to give useful information. All right, let's move on to the next one. That is Reg from app. There's also Process Activity View, which is another tool from Nearsoft. The interface looks very much the same. What you can do with that is file, start a new process, point it someplace. And that one you actually see is working for me. You can see at that particular point when I started up Firefox, it was accessing these DLLs in the system, probably some kind of a function call to those, and what files around the system it's accessing, which can be useful information.
However, this particular version of Portable Firefox may not be as stealthy as I expected, because it looks like inside of temp, it's opening up some extra files, which might contain data that I don't want to let all the world know about. Actually, I'm going to open that selected file just to see what's in it.
See what's in it, plus see who might be... You think somebody
might be leaking stuff out, yeah. Which is one of the reasons I said selected file wipers is kind of lost cause, because so many different Windows tools jam data in all sorts of different locations where it's hard to get rid of everything. Regardless, if you want to test out the forensics usability of certain apps, those tools are all useful because they can show you where in the registry and where in the file system odds and ends are writing to. It's a possibility. I'm just thinking that what it should do is just the program I started up and any child processes, but... Alright, let me go back to my slides. Okay, portable apps, they have a bunch of different portable apps you can run from a thumb drive, though to be sure they're not adding stuff into like the local temp directory, use some of the tools I mentioned before. They have portable versions of Firefox, for instance. They might have one of Chrome, they have one of Pigeon, all sorts of different email clients and so forth. If you're interested in the Tor browser bundle, you can get it from the torproject.org. If you're more of an Opera user than you are a Firefox user, there's also a tool called Operator, which is very much the same thing except for it's Tor with Opera rolled in. And once again, keep in mind, Tor does not equal secure. Tor is designed for anonymity? Not necessarily security. I can't say the word anonymity.
Give me a while, dude. It does work.
Okay. Now, I showed you, even on those portable ones, though, where I'm running from a thumb drive, it looks like it's writing some stuff to the local C drive. I don't want that. There's some other options of things you can do that can help along the way to keep things somewhat more secure. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to shut down this machine. And we're going to talk about boot media for a second. Let me shrink that down for a second. There's all sorts of different... How many people here have ever used a bootable CD? How many people have ever used a Windows bootable CD? All right, there's all sorts of different... the easiest way to do this is generally in Linux. If you're booting from the CD-ROM itself, well, you're not booting from the hard drive. Hopefully, you're not writing to the hard drive at all. There's a weird exception to that. If you're using a Linux boot CD, look up a parameter called no swap. Sometimes when you're doing the boot at the syslinux prompt, you have to put in no swap to make sure it doesn't use a swap partition that's already on the hard drive. My understanding, by default, the Ubuntu install CD that also doubles as a live CD does not do that. And that if you use Canopix, it also doesn't do it if you use this. Now, the problem is CDs are kind of a pain to carry with you all the time. From the Linux side of things, I've had good luck. Who has ever used Unetbooten? I like to say it with a German accent. Unetbooten. Mm-hmm. Unetbooten, essentially, if it's a syslinux-based ISO, you can take that Linux ISO you would normally burn to a CD-ROM, point Unetbooten at that ISO, point the other end at your thumb drive and make a bootable thumb drive that loads that OS. These things are about 11 or 12 bucks. This is actually a thumb drive. Go ahead and switch over to 2. Is it showing up?
Yep.
This is a bootable thumb drive. I think it cost me 11 or 12 bucks. It's 4 gigs, which is plenty for my purposes. And I loaded up with a bunch of different OSs. I have one in my pocket that has Backtrack on it. Backtrack is a security distribution for doing all sorts of pen testing. I have another one that has Windows on it, or specifically Ultimate Boot CD for Windows. And another one, I think I have either Conboot or maybe just Ubuntu install CD. Go ahead and switch back, please. Thank you. But that's a lot more convenient to carry with you. If you're interested in using certain Windows tools from Boot Media, then look into Bot's PE Builder, Ultimate Book CD for Windows, or WinBuilder. WinBuilder is a newer project. I haven't played with it enough. Now, Ultimate Book CD for Windows and Bot's PE Builder both take, you have to give it a Windows Service Pack 2 or newer Windows XP CD. Sorry, Windows XP Service Pack 2 or newer XP CD. It ships off just the stuff it needs to make a mini installer of NT on the CD that you can boot. The problem is that so far these ones don't support building from Vista. There's some stuff inside of WinBuilder that does. However, Ultimate Book CD for Windows is currently my preferred one because it's Bot's PE Builder with a bunch of plugins already thrown in, which is awfully nifty. And if anybody wants to try some of these live CDs later on, just come up and grab one. I have them. Can't let you keep the Windows ones because it's a license to me. That's another problem with the Windows ones is you pretty much have to build the ISO yourself because legally they can't distribute them. There's some people who have been via BitTorrent on Pirate Bay and so forth, but it's not exactly legal. The Linux side of things, they are. And the nice thing I said once again about using these boot media, everything is done in memory. So unless, of course, for some reason they're writing out to your swap, and there's ways of keeping it from writing out to your swap using the right boot parameters. So as soon as the machine is shut down, that data is gone. With one exception. Who here has heard of cold boot attacks? Alright, cold boot attack is essentially this. Some researchers found that if you take a machine, quickly shut it down, pull out the RAM, put it into another machine, keep it cool in the process, put it in another machine, you can recover stuff out of the RAM. There's a certain amount of persistence even without power. However, people made a big deal about this attack, and I guess it is a somewhat big deal, but quite frankly, if I'm up there bum-rushing someone, let's say I wanted to get Mike's password off that machine or see what his web activity, if I have enough time to bum-rush him, knock him aside, take his machine, take that memory out, image it, Mike's got bigger problems than me just seeing that he's looking at, you know, I don't know, a battle Nazi midget Eskimo porn or whatever.
There's some hot swap RAM, some server boxes
might
be worse than.
Yeah, but then someone's got to get into your someone's in your server cage, aren't they?
Yeah, but physical
security. It ultimately comes down to physical security, and if you really want to keep people from a bigger issue to me as far as laptops and memory and people being able to recover stuff from it, is your hibernation file. Yeah. Let's say you close your laptop up and then leave it someplace and it leaves a hibernation file. There's stuff that can be recovered from that, and I may be able to show something similar to that here in a bit. But as far as boot CDs is concerned, I may have to come back to this. Where did I leave it? It's kind of a pain to have to reboot my presentation machine. So instead, what I'm going to do is... No. That's the parameter in VMware you have to use to tell it to do a boot wait. Which, let me see if I did that. Oh, good, I already have it set up. The nice thing about VMware is you can test so many different things. One thing you can do is testing booting from the ISO as if it was a CD in the virtual machine. Which I already have. Most of you seem to have seen Linux Live CDs before. This is Ultimate Boot CD for Windows. And I've actually thought about teaching a class in the future about how to create your own boot media. I could launch Ultimate Boot CD for Windows, which brings up a cut-down version of Windows. It's all running from the CD-ROM or thumb drive. The nice thing about it, though, it comes with it's a multi-boot system. It has Derek's Boot Nuke on it, which is used for wiping the drive. It has FreeDOS, if you know, you want to go old school. Memory test stuff, go back remover tool, NTFS for DOS, offline NT password and registry editor. Anybody ever use this before? Yeah. Essentially, you can go in and do a hash insertion on the SAM file and either blank the password or enter your own password. There's better ways of doing that, actually, but we'll talk about that in Windows Recovery Console. I'm going to say launch on a boot CD for Windows. Oh, by the way, if anybody tries to put this on a thumb drive and has problems, let me know. There's one little exception to writing it to a thumb drive. all the tools and documentation from the website worked, except it would always blue screen on every single piece of hardware I personally had. Mm. Then I found someone had some information on how to use a hex editor to edit your, what is it? It's a ntdetect.com. And after I did that, it worked reliable every time. So if you, anybody needs that ntdetect.com, let me know, and I'll even find you the information on what you need to do in the hex editor, or I'll get the ntdetect.com to you. But being able to boot this from my little thumb drive, like the ones I showed you in my pocket, is just so much more convenient. Hmm. Is it back on the computer?
Computer, yeah.
Okay, cool. Alright, eventually Ultimate Boot CD for Windows is going to come up here. And the reason I like it is, it comes with a version of Firefox, though it's probably somewhat out of date. You can run IE from it, and there's so many other tools, like, were you asking me about also the system recovery CDs? Or who was asking me about system recovery CDs, antivirus, and so forth?
Oh, yeah, that was me.
That was you. Okay, it's really, really good for those particular types of functionality. If it ever actually comes up. I can start up with network support. Since I'm not going to use the network, I'm going to say no. There we go. And that's all booted from a CD. Well, technically it's booted from an ISO and a VM, but you get the point. And it's using a RAM drive. If I wanted to, I could access the local C drive, which is nice. But it comes with tons of tools. Besides the networking tools, I can remote desktop into some other machine. I can secure shell into another machine. If I go underneath of... in one of these categories, it has Firefox and so forth. If you see, this is Internet Explorer. I'm pretty sure it has Firefox on this particular distribution as well. It has all sorts of anti-spyware tools and antivirus tools. The reason these are useful is, who has ever tried to remove a piece of spyware and had the problem that you couldn't remove it because the file was locked, or as soon as you removed it, it had a companion process that automatically started it up because you were booting from the same operating system you were trying to remove from. Well, now you're booting from the CD-ROM, a read-only piece of media, and none of those processes are started, so you can get absolutely everything. So sometimes this is just the best thing for doing that. Also, it has a bunch of registry tools for editing the registry on the machine. You were asking about that earlier. I sometimes use it for that. Also, if you go into password tools, it has something called Salas Password Renewal. You point it at the Windows install on the local C drive, and you can even create a new admin account to log in as, or you can change the password for a local admin account. Unfortunately, if you do that, EFS doesn't work. We'll talk a little bit about EFS a little bit later on, but that's one minor drawback, I suppose. But you can just see there's a ton of different tools on here that can be useful to you. And trying to know where. Anyway, look at the Ultimate Boot CD for Windows sometime, and I think you'll find it pretty handy. It's nifty stuff. Alright, restart and say okay. Because I'm gonna use that VM some more later. But that's doing stuff in boot media, which really, from a simplicity standpoint, probably is one of the best calls when it comes to occult computing. Is there any questions about boot media? Yes, Mike.
Do you, on Backtrack 4 or any of the Backtracks, let's say you just decide to run it off thumb drive or whatever, are they going to just... I haven't looked at it. Do they run anything on a swap file?
I'm honestly not sure what the default on Backtrack is. You have to talk to the developers on that or post in the forums. My guess is they wouldn't want to. Historically speaking, Backtrack team has been pretty conscious about not trying to leave records laying around of what the CD is doing. Like in the past, they wouldn't even set up the networking about you telling it to. I'm not sure about swap or not. I would have to ask on their forums and they can tell you. Alright, that moves us on to selective file removal and encryption, for those that don't want to go all the way. And I'm also going to illustrate why this is kind of a lost cause.
There's one tool I mentioned before for automatically doing this. You can manually go in and on for each and every file you want deleted, use one of these selective, file overriding utilities to delete it. But that could be a bit of a pain because there's a lot of different places Windows stores stuff. But there's several different tools out there that will automatically go out to some of the more common places that Windows jams data and clear it for you. Clean After Me is one of them, which I showed here a second ago. There's another one called CCleaner, which is pretty good. I prefer these two because, the nice thing about them is they're free. There's other ones out there people talk about, like Evidence Eliminator and so forth, but I really don't see a point in paying for this stuff. If you want to, if you want to show off CCleaner, I showed off Clean After Me, and it's pretty easy stuff to run. Let's see if this came back up. There we go. If you're using, I'm gonna show you how to use these selective file wipers. Like I said, I'll show why that's similar to Lost Cars. If someone's just interested in hiding their stuff, like, I didn't want, my girlfriend to know what kind of, stuff I'm looking at on the internet, then these selective file wipers are probably good enough. The problem is they're not necessarily good enough for hiding data from people who are really technically savvy and know how to look down the hard drive of a hex editor to find data. But let me open one of these up. Underneath selective file wipers. Oh, sorry, wrong one. Underneath track covering. Clean After Me has so many different features of things it deletes. One is, of course, anything in Windows Explorer, and I covered some of those. You can essentially just select the things you want to delete. Some stuff you want to leave. One of the key signs that someone has been cleaning stuff off the machine is if nothing is there. Any machine that's used,
just bought it,
is going to have some stuff. If there's nothing in the event log, you got some pretty good clues that someone's been hosing the system. If you're going to use Clean After Me, though, make sure you go into Advanced Options and don't let it just do a simple delete. Tell it to zero the bytes out. CCleaner has similar functionality. And by the way, there's some crossover where both of them do the same thing, and some plugins that CCleaner does that the Clean After Me doesn't, and vice versa. For instance, Clean After Me, you might notice one of the things it had listed was wipe information about installed USB devices. I'll explain why that's important here in a bit. Keep in mind, though, it doesn't really clear all the records as well as it should. And I'll explain that here in a bit, too. CCleaner, you can choose what you want to remove, and you can get really selective. Like, sometimes you want to keep your history, or sometimes you want to keep your passwords, you just want to delete certain things. You can do that. You can check off in the registry what things you want cleared. But one of the things you really want to do is go underneath Options, and I believe it's, Options Settings. And you can say Secure File Delete, and say how many passes you want to do. Generally speaking, one pass is going to be it's going to definitely be much faster, and on modern hardware, just as secure. Just go with one pass. If you really have time and you want to waste it, go ahead and use the Gutman 35 pass. But essentially, you just choose, what was that? Overkill. I'll explain more in a bit, and I have some references to back up what I'm saying, but yeah, pretty much on modern hardware, anything like 2001 and after.
I just bought
them. Yeah, that it's kind of a conservative organization since they really don't want stuff discovered.
It's a three passes
unrecoverable. Well, one pass is, and modern hardware is pretty much unrecoverable. Mm. But anyway, you can go here to CCleaner, choose the things you want to clean, say Run Cleaner, and it will strip all that stuff out. It's really relatively easy to use. Now, let's say instead, though, you wanted to just selectively wipe individual files. And I'm actually going to show that here in a second. Luckily, you loaned me a smaller thumb drive so I could do this.
Those type of wipes are going to take care of slack space.
Well, some wiping tools take care of slack space and some don't. Generally speaking, the wiping tools will take care of the file up to how many bytes are allocated to it. I've seen some that do cater to Slack space and some that don't. Some will go, well, the file is 512 bytes long, so I write over 512 bytes, but it doesn't write over the rest of the cluster. Some do, some don't. I'm gonna show a tool called sdelete here in a second, and it doesn't. But to illustrate that, anybody who actually brought a thumb drive with them, they can try this. Luckily, I have a very small thumb drive that you loaned to me that makes this somewhat simpler. Because doing this with a full-size, a large modern thumb drive can be painful. But I have a little thumb drive here. I formatted it in TFS. And the thing I want to point out to you right now, this is an interesting bit of trivia. Who all here is using Windows Vista or Windows 7? How many people are using Windows XP? You're going to notice a big difference here. Windows XP, if you do a normal format, it does not overwrite each and every sector with nulls. Windows Vista and newer, it does. So I noticed this recently when I was doing something called file carving, which I'll explain in a bit. But here recently, I formatted this all in TFS. And at this point, I'm going to copy some files to this system. On the sample data, I have a bunch of pictures, and I have a few text files. I'm going to take all that CRUD, copy it, and put it on my blank NTFS formatted thumb drive. Now, I have a handy dandy tool inside a bin for actually visualizing how things are laid out on that thumb drive. If I go underneath a bin and find a tool called Disk View, I can point that at my thumb drive, which in my case is F, and it actually will show me where files are located by logical sector on that disk. Well, on that media, I should say. Like I click here, that's the MFT, Master File Table, for NTFS. It's basically the equivalent of what the FAT table is on a FAT file system. You see down here these little blue files? Well, that's that JPEG I had up before. That's file2.txt. And this one is, well, that's used for conversion from uppercase to lowercase in NTFS. There's file one. If a file is small enough on NTFS, it'll store it directly in the MFT. I believe that's referred to as resident data. So I had to make some files big enough to where it's not going to do that. But you see, it pretty much wrote everything more or less to the middle of the disk, which you can visualize right there. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to show you how deleting a file isn't really deleting it. I'm going to try to visually illustrate it. I'm going to go back to my computer, and for anybody that's following along, just right-click on whichever thumb drive you have, and I'm going to say Properties, Tools, defragment. Actually, I got a better idea. Never mind. Skip that. Go out to the command line. Do it the right way, the way God intended. Alright.
Let's see his computer.
Defrag F colon. By the way, defragging Flash normally isn't really all that useful an idea, but I want to illustrate something with this particular class. I'll run it again just to make sure everything is nice and lined up. Alright, I'm going to go back into disk view here in a second. And here's the layout currently, or where it was a minute second ago. Let me do a refresh. Notice how all the files are now at the front of the disk. And no longer all here. Well, that's not 100% true. The file allocation table, or I should say the MFT, they don't call it the file allocation table in NTFS, has basically pointed to a new location. But file systems are lazy, and rightfully so. It would take time to actually delete those files off of where they were. So instead, it just copies them and then changes the pointers. If I was to go into a hex editor, I could actually go and see them, which is what we're going to do right now. Some of this might seem redundant, but I think actually illustrating it and getting a visual of what's going on can help people to understand why we do the things that we do. I'm going to go underneath text and disk editors. Well, actually, I'm going in a second. First, I'm going to go into sample data. You see I have a file called file1. All it is the word start file1 over and over and over again. At the very end, it's file1 end. The reason I did that, I needed a simple string so I could easily search my drive. Alright, how many times should file1 end appear on this file system, assuming it was completely blank before I copied it there?
Once.
Just once. Well, let me go in. That's correct.
Actually, what?
It'd be twice. While you're running the program, creating the file, it's automatic saving the temp file.
Well, actually, that's not. You're right, but that's not exactly the reason. The reason is, remember how it was originally more in the center of the disk? Now it's in the front of the disk? Well, it never overwrote the spot where it was in the center of the disk. Well, and technically, all right, this isn't a disk. But once again, this is easier to illustrate on these little flash drives than it is a big.
It's leaving in the background.
Yes. So I'm going to go into hex editors. And I've included a couple hex editors in my download. I got the demoware version of WinHex, which is a nifty little hex editor. And here you can go in, and actually you can open up RAM and hex edit it too, which is neat. Hmm. Or at least look at it. I don't know if it actually live edits that. I'm going to say open disk. I can open by a logical value name, or sorry, drive name. But instead, I'm going to point directly at the media itself. That way I can see all the partitions. Alright, and here are my partitions. Now I'm going to search it for fine text. And I'm going to have it, instead of giving you back direct results, I'm going to have it list them for me. I'm going to search for file 1 end. And let's see how many times it finds it on the drive. Found it 2 times. By the way, the reason that you see a third time at the very top, that's because I ran this one other time. It's still bookmarked from the last time I ran this tool. These two are the important ones. You see, it found it once here, and once much further on down the drive, more towards the center. That's because it was left there. If I was actually going to look at it, you see it right there?
Yep.
And basically, the hex editor allows me to see what's really on the disk directly. Like, I can jump straight there and see it. Oh, if I scroll to the very top of the drive, you can sometimes tell what... Actually, I'm not at the top of the drive because I think I'm selected the wrong thing. Let me go ahead and close out all this and delete it. But you see it found it that data on there twice. That's because it didn't actually remove it after the defrag. Actually, on second foot, I'm going to put that back. Touch fine text. I just wanted to show twice. I clear that history so to do that. I have a tool in here called S-Delete. What S-Delete does is, I believe it's referred to as a short DOD wipe. It, if I remember right, it zeros it out, it ones it out, and then it puts random data over the entire file.
Hmm.
I'm going to run that here in a second.
Then after you do that, it can be, thumb drive can be used again. Like,
yes.
Like it's never,
but
like a brand new.
This is also illustrate why selected file wiping is semi-pointless. I'm going to change directory into desktop. Desktop, any forensics tools, I think it's selected file wipers. There's a tool called S-Delete. If I can type. On the F drive, there was a file, and you see it right here, I believe it is. It's called file 1. And you see it currently contains the words file 1, file 1, file 1 over and over again. Oh, another nice thing about these hex editors, if you go to the top, sometimes you can tell what they are, without actually opening the file directly, the disk directly, what file system is, and even what was used to format the file system. For instance, if I make a FAT32 file system, it's going to say something like, I want to say it's like MS-DOS 5.0. If I do it inside of Linux, it says make file system. It shows different things. I actually had a drive I was going to bring with me to illustrate that. But sometimes you can tell what operating system was used to format a drive based on what it puts in those headers. But, all right, here's file one. I'm going to use sdelete and tell it to delete file one securely, essentially meaning overwriting it. And I see it did a one pass to override it. Actually, I was thinking the wrong thing. Cipher is what does the free wipe. But let me see if I can get that to refresh. All right, here's where file one was originally. And notice how there's nothing but garbage there. Also notice it didn't overwrite the rest of the cluster. It doesn't get slack space. It gets the file itself, but it doesn't get slack space, which isn't so great. However, while I securely deleted that file, because I did the defrag just before, file one is still there. So let's say someone's trying to get away with something. If they're using defrag or any utility that for some reason might move the file from one place in the drive to another, it's possible that they'll delete the file, but because the file was someplace else in the drive earlier, the data's still there. Do you get the point? Kind of makes sense?
So you have to go back and do it again or get rid of that, right?
Yes, but the only thing you really do is wipe the entire drive. There's some other stopgap measures. There's something called Cipher, which I'll talk about in a bit, which can kind of help. It's part of the EFS suite. Should have been in, I think, starting like with Windows 2000. But here I was searching for file one end. I want to talk a little bit right now about who's here ever heard of data carving? Data carving is basically you're going down a drive, whether or not it has a file system on it, and instead of looking in the file location table for where a file is, you go down byte for byte down the entire drive going, okay, I'm looking for this particular signature because I know this signifies the beginning of the file. And I'm looking for this particular type of ending because I think that's the end of the file. And now I can reassemble the entire file. For instance, does anybody happen to know something that's inside the header of pretty much all JPEGs? What's that?
Yo-ya.
Yo-ya?
Beginning of a binary, it's Y-O-Y-A, beginning of every JPEG.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think what I have is not quite the beginning, but I know it's in there. I'm going to search for J-F-I-F. Well, first of all, let me go back to the listing of my thumb drive. How many JPEGs do I have here? I have 1, 2, 3 JPEGs. So you'd think JFIF would show up 3 times. Because of the whole system defrag thing, it actually shows up 6 times. But yeah, there you go. Here's the one you're talking about. That is the very beginning. I just have a harder time typing that than I do GFIF. But a file carver, what it would do is actually go down the drive, look for those headers and footers, and extract the data. Basically, all this is here to point out between system defrags, Windows moving stuff around deliberately, and temp files. It's really hard to get away with selective file wiping. Now, I'm going to move on to showing some stuff about... Also, notice that sdelete didn't actually wipe the rest of the cluster. I wish I'd had a better tool for instead of writing all zeros, like writing all some other pattern. There's some ways I can do that with DD. Because then I can illustrate how it just overwrote... It saw that the file was, let's say, 600 bytes long, so it just overwrote 600 bytes. There's some other tools that do a slightly better job for individually deleting files. If we go underneath of, let me see. All right, does DD, this is a tool that most of your Linux distributions will have. I also have included a Windows version. If I wanted to override an individual file, I could just say DD and point it at the individual file, tell it a block size to use, and how many times override it, and it'll just go ahead and do it for me. And that's the URL here that I use for downloading this version of DD. Those S-delete, which I just showed, both of those, though, I don't believe is going to get the slack space. There's another tool called Eraser, which I've included in that package. Eraser actually will, and you can actually set up Eraser to automatically schedule when to do its erasing. And it can actually be designed, I think it says wipe in clusters. I don't know if it terms it slack space, but it can do slack space. For anybody here that's a Unix guru, there's a tool called Shred that does the same thing that S-delete does, but in a Unix environment. There's also a tool that you can use if you are, I think it's running Windows 2000 or newer, called Cypher. Now what Cypher does, and I've yet to find out for sure if it hits slack space or not. I know it hits unused space. I'm not sure if it hits slack space. What Cypher does is, well, first of all, let me show you. See how most of this disk is all zeros? I'm going to hit this bad boy with Cypher for a bit. Cypher is a command that is meant to be able to manage encrypted file system from the command line. But it can do other things as well. For instance, you can tell it to wipe free space on a drive. So I'm going to point it at F drive. I'm going to use the slash W. And assuming I didn't write that wrong, the first thing it's going through is it's looking at the entire disk and overriding it with zeros. Then it's going to override it with, I believe, all ones, which is going to represent FF in this case. And then finally, it's going to override it with random data. The way I've set things up on some of my systems is it's not as good as full hard drive encryption, but I suppose it can help. I have set scheduled to automatically run at 2 a.m. every night my little defrag and cypher.bat file. What it does is it defrags the hard drive a couple of times. I know it seems silly to do it multiple times. Sometimes, you know, I like looking at the illustration and seeing everything in front of the disk. It's just a silly psychological thing more than anything else. And then at the end, it runs this cypher command. I do my defrags first so I don't have that problem I just illustrated. Then I'm on Cypher at the end. And that Cypher is going to take a little while to run, but I'll bring up that in the hex editor hopefully here in a bit, just to give you an idea. And you switch back to the computer?
Yeah.
Cool, thank you. If you want more information on the selective file encryption, you can selectively encrypt the file using EFS, and if you have like a Windows XP Pro or anything like that, it's actually relatively simple. You actually see that? That's something that is created because of the Cypher running.
No.
Let me try to get to my desktop. EFS is fairly simple to actually use. If I had a file here, let's say this is a blank text document, I could right-click on it. I can go to its properties, advanced, and I can say encrypt it. Please notice I can also compress it. I'm going to talk about that here in a second. If I say encrypt it, it should prompt me, do I want to encrypt the parent folder as well? The reason it's asking me for this is a lot of things, when they open a file, they'll also write a temporary version of that file to the same directory. Well, if the parent directory isn't also encrypted, then you just made a plain text version of the file. And granted, it's probably going to delete it as soon as you close the program. It's going to delete its temp. It's still there. So it offers that. But that's how easy it is to encrypt the file. The problem is, it's basing that encryption on your password that you log in with. So if someone can crack your password or get it, then yeah, you're out of luck. Someone can decrypt that file. The way it works is basically your password is sort of used as the key to the, I think it's called a FEC, which is basically the actual key that encrypts the file. So your key's public key encrypts the FEC and attaches it to the file so that whenever you log in later on, your private key decrypts the FEC and unencrypts the file. By doing it this way, they can attach multiple versions of the FEC to it, like one for you and one for the administrator, so either one of you could decrypt the file. Does that make some kind of sense? But the problem with this I'm not sure for all the reasons, but I've been told EFS is kind of scoffed at by some people in the forensics community because it's apparently, depending on how they implement it, not particularly useful. For one thing, I was talking about temp files. That could be a possible problem with EFS. Not to mention, if someone copies off your SAML system file and cracks your password, that's an issue. Though, I thought maybe I could bypass EFS by changing the person's password using that boot CD I showed earlier. That didn't work. And there's also a tool. Who has heard of Conboot? Conboot's neat. Conboot is basically a little bootloader you can run from a CD or a disk or even a thumb drive. You boot from it. It's K-O-N-B-O-O-T. What it does is you boot from it, it modifies memory and acts as a bootloader. You point it at your Windows install, then it loads up Windows. When it does that, it automatically blanks the admin password. And you can just log straight in. What's that? Like what?
Windows Gate.
I haven't heard of that one.
There's another free. It's got two different mechanisms for booting into Windows without a password.
Conboot also has much the same thing though for doing it in Linux. So Conboot works like, but it works in a different way. It doesn't blank the password. It like creates a password that you have to use. But you get the idea. But for those reasons, people don't like EFS. Also, if you want to use EFS and you really want to make it more secure, there's something called SysKey, which is an extra way of encrypting the, since I don't know, it's like NT4, Service Pack 3, SysKeys existed. Basically, they added an extra level of encryption on the password hashes that are stored in the SAM file. But the problem is, where most people implement SysKey, the SysKey is still on the system. It's now in the system file. So that's why when you crack passwords with Kane off a down system, you have to copy both the system file and the SAM file to crack it. You can put the SysKey on a USB drive, but a lot of people don't. And if you're going to go through all the trouble of doing that, you might as well just go ahead and use BitLocker if you're using a modern version of Windows. Also, no problem with EFS is it's implemented by Microsoft. I don't mean to sound it as a hit, but it is closed source. You don't have people looking at it. And that's not exactly reassuring. Other tools out there like TrueCrypt can do much the same thing and can work on multiple platforms. And if you go underneath of installers, we have TrueCrypt. I'm going to go ahead and run it and install it. Luckily, it shouldn't take too long. One of the things I like about TrueCrypt, let's see if I can find it on here.
There you go.
One of the things I like about TrueCrypt is you can actually use it to encrypt your system partition even if you just have Windows XP. So you don't necessarily need to go update to get a BitLocker-like functionality. You'll actually encrypt your system partition and do whole hard drive encryption. Another nice thing about it is instead of using passwords, you can actually use a key file. Instead of having to type in a password to unlock your folder, what you can do is you can say, this JPEG over here, this is my key file. Use its pattern as my password. That's a nice feature. Right now, though, I'm just going to show how to create a quick volume in TrueCrypt. I'm going to, create a new volume. And I'm actually going to get somewhat more complex. I'm going to create, create a encrypted file container, and I'm going to tell it to create a hidden TrueCrypt volume. And I'll explain more about that in a second. Essentially, with TrueCrypt, you can have two different volumes in one file. The idea is that you can have two different passwords. One password opens up one volume, and a different password opens up a different volume. This is sometimes referred to as steganography, or in this case, deniable encryption. The idea is that if someone comes along and saying, we know you have this encrypted volume, give us the password, you can give them the password, and they decrypt it and say, oh, there's the stuff, and you might have tax documents or something like that. However, if they knew the other password, it would give them nuclear bomb plans. It's a way of doing that. Let me go ahead and I'm going to create a hidden volume. And the first thing I had to do before I create a hidden volume is I had to create a normal volume. I'm going to select the file, and I'm just going to I'm going to put a quick volume on the desktop. and I'm going to call it t.tc. You don't have to use the extension tc, and actually it's better if you don't, because tc is a common name for using for TrueCrypt volumes. For obvious reasons, you don't want to do that. So right now we're creating the outer volume. This is the one we're willing to give away our password for. And we're just going to use AES encryption. There's all sorts of other ciphers. And quite frankly, I'm not a cryptography expert, so I can't tell you. You might want to run the test just to, let me see. There's a benchmark thing to say which one is running the fastest on your particular system. Though, generally speaking, it's always going to be AES. I'm just going to go with the base. AES, I'm going to tell it to make me 100 megabyte. And I'm for the outer volume password, I'm going to just make it password, spelled in a funky way. Actually, it's pass in a funky way. I could also use the key file. I had introduced entropy. Entropy is basically randomness. And instead of having, computers really don't generate random numbers in a true sense. So I have to do something to make it have randomness. So I just move my mouse pointer around. When I'm happy, I just say format. And I have a couple different options on cluster size and what partition, what file system to actually put inside of this hidden volume. Alright. I'm not going to put any files over 4 gigs in it, so I'll just, especially since it's only 100 megabytes, so that's good enough. That was the outer volume. Now I can create the hidden volume. I'm going to pretty much go over the exact same settings for the hidden volume. I can only make it 99. It has to be small. The hidden volume has to be smaller than the outer volume. I'm going to make it 10 megs. Now, the nice thing about this is, let's see, I'm going to give it a different password. I'm going to call it test test. Put a little entropy in there, and format. Now, the one problem with hidden volumes is, is it? I think it may have just created it, and I just skipped past it totally. Alright, I think I just created it. Let me go open it up. Let me go mount. Sorry, I have to select the file first. Point to the desktop, and we'll mount it, and I'm going to use my password from outer volume. By the way, if I was to open up that file, it should look like nothing but random data. There we go. If it was opened up in a hex editor, it looks like nothing but random data. And the file size is already 100 megabytes. We have to do it that way for security reasons. We don't want someone to do some kind of statistical attack. Alright, here, right here on drive J, I can put a file. And let me actually put this little text document there. Now I'm going to go ahead and close this down. And let me see. Dismount all. And I'm going to remount it. But this time I'm going to use my other password, the one from my hidden volume. And notice this time, when I open it up, that file's not there. I could have a totally different set of files in that particular hidden one. Now the problem with this is, you pretty much, if you make too much stuff in the outer volume, you're eventually going to overwrite the hidden volume. There's no way they could do it without it necessarily giving away the fact that there's a hidden volume. That's one disadvantage. And the other disadvantage is if someone never uses the standard volume at all, then it comes obvious they're not, because all the dates in it are something ancient. So obviously they're not using it. So that's all problems with that. But that's using TrueCrypt. The nice thing with TrueCrypt is I can take this little TC file and then mount it in Linux as well. And once again, you don't want to call it TC, you want to call it something else. And if someone was to look at that file directly, if I was to point a hex editor to at it and open it up, well, it says it's in use. So let me go ahead and go back into TrueCrypt, dismount all.
You just wanted to call it .hex.
Yeah, you could. The problem with that, a lot of people suggest as Andy Forensics, just changing the file extension. The biggest problem with doing that is, if someone uses a data carver or a hex editor, well, for instance, if I was to go in there, first of all, 100 meg docx isn't very likely, usually. And if someone was to open it up and see nothing but random data, they have a quick idea that that's not really a docx file. There's ways of doing that, though, and I'll hopefully get a chance to cover that if they don't kick us out of here. Sorry, guys, I thought this was going to go along a little faster than it did. I have a lot, so much odds and ends to cover. Let me go back in and... I never actually closed it down. Did my cipher command finish? Yes, cipher finished. Let me go back in and go to my hex editors, WinHex. If anybody has to step out and go to the bathroom, I understand. I'm going to keep continuing, though, just because we only have to 4:30. I'm going to try to cover all the material if I can. All right. Notice how I just opened up the disk again and how instead of being mostly zeros, it's mostly random data. That's because of the cipher command I used just a bit ago. That's just to give you an idea. Now I'm going to move back to... By the way, if you want to look at other alternative open source file encryption utilities, look up free OTFE. I hear good things about it. The one advantage it has over TrueCrypt is, with TrueCrypt, they have something called Traveler Mode, where you can unencrypt your volume using just the tools off a thumb drive, but you still have to be an admin on the local box. That's a pain. Free OTFE, they actually have this Explorer package that you can use that it mounts it like a zip file, and you can pull files into and out of it, which is not quite as good, but in a pinch it'll work. I found something called TrueCrypt Explorer. I never did get the work well. Also, if a utility says it's encrypting something, an interesting way of testing this, good encryption, it should look completely random. If it compresses well, it's probably not really encrypted. If I tried to compress that file I just created with a zip, it wouldn't shrink down much at all. Okay, going back to reasons why selective file wiping is not necessarily a good idea. First of all, as I've pointed out several times so far, Windows jams data in all sorts of places, so that makes it sort of a losing game right there. The main file may be wiped, but not necessarily the temp file, or in the cases I showed, where defrag had left parts of the file in other locations. Also, there's USB device logs. Now, you saw that Clean After Me was able to erase what USB devices had been connected to the box, but it only erased them from some parts of the registry, not all parts of the registry, because there's multiple places they can be stored. And actually, that article I put out recently, you can look on there for other locations for where you can find. And one of the reasons you might be interested in that kind of material is, let's say, for instance, let me go back into Ben. USB DView. Let's say you're an accounting auditor and you think someone's keeping records of their embezzlement but not on the machine, on a thumb drive. Well, you can go in here and see that, hey, they have this thumb drive they're using and I know it's been mounted as these drive letters before and I have the vendor ID so I know who made it. I might even have a product ID and a serial number in here so you can track down that particular thumb drive. Also, let's say someone's a police officer and they want to inspect, they know someone has a camera and they want to look for evidence on it. Well, as you can see, on this particular machine, sometime in the recent past, I've had a Canon camera. So, if someone does a seizure at the computer but they don't find those particular digital items, they might have to go back and get a search warrant to get extra materials. But I found all that stuff with USB DView. Now, this other tool can delete that, but there's a couple other keys and files where that information is stored. So I just want you all to know that. And I have that listed in that forensically interesting spots in the Windows 7 registry. That article, it says Windows 7, but a lot of it applies to Vista and XP as well. All right, let me go back to my PowerPoint slides. All right, page and hibernation files. I mentioned this somewhat before. If you have a page file, everybody knows what a page file is, right? You know, you start running out of memory, you start writing to the hard drive's page file. Well, sometimes you can do what's known as file carving on that, and stuff like images, passwords, and so forth gets jammed into there with the right tools, people can recover it. That's where data carving comes in. I've already explained the defrag issue in great detail. Oh, the USB device logs I was mentioning, those are some common places. Nearest tool will wipe out this registry key, but it will not write. It wipes out this registry key, but it doesn't wipe out this one. Now, so it might erase some information about what webcams the person has hooked up, but if it's a USB storage device, you'll still find information about it here. And if you go look in this particular setup api.dev.log file, you'll find more information about what USB devices have been attached to the box. Alright, I'm back on the computer. Cool. Alright, page file. Oh, Linux folks, look for the swap partition. That would be your equivalent for where people might have data jammed. If you want to disable the page file, you can do that. Actually, let me demonstrate that in a second. I'll explain why you want to get rid of the page file. Sometimes Windows isn't happy if you get rid of the page file, but if you really don't want data getting jammed in there, you may have to go in and disable it. If you go into this particular spot in the control panel, you can do that. Also, if you want to wipe page... Did you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. What's that? Make sure you have a bunch of RAM if you're going to do that. I have 4 gigs of RAM in this machine. I might be able to get away with it. But even then, sometimes Windows still expects to have a page file. Oh, if you go in this particular registry spot, you can turn it to 1, and it will wipe the page file on closing. Unfortunately, it takes for freaking ever. So it's not a good solution from that standpoint. It's just so slow. You can also go into your policy editor and do much the same thing. Hibernation file, this is what's made when you shut down your machine, it goes into hibernation mode. Memory gets put that into there, into this hibernation file, and you can sometimes recover data from that as well. That brings me to the lovely topic of data carving. And so I'm going a little fast, I just want to make sure we get everything covered before the day is over with. If anybody has any questions, just feel free to ask along the way. Data carving is essentially this. I showed you how earlier I used the hex editor, went down the disk, looked for GFIF instead of yo-yo, just because I can't write those monkey characters. And I was able to find where the JPEGs were physically on the drive. Well, people have made lovely automating tools for doing this. Now, you probably may have heard of Scalpel and Foremost. If you wanted a little bit more control, these are probably better tools than the ones I'm going to show. But I was too lazy while making this presentation, so I'm going to show you some really easy, nifty Windows tools for doing much the same thing. Well, Disk Digger is a Windows tool. However, PhotoRec comes for Windows, Linux, I think OS X, everything. PhotoRec is probably all in all a better tool as far as the total number of types of files it covers, but Disk Digger is easier to use. So let's actually bring up Disk Digger, and I'm going to show you why it's so cool. Underneath of the package I gave everybody, if you go underneath of data carvers, you see a tool called Disk Digger. Disk Digger has 2 modes of operation. It can look at the physical media's file table, either its FAT table or its MFT, and look for deleted files that haven't been overwritten yet. Or it can actually go byte for byte down the entire disk. For instance, let me say I go out to my F drive. And you see I have all that stuff there. Well, let me just delete it. It's gone. If I use this and say next, let me see. I can say scan file system, and what it's going to do is it's going to look at MFT for stuff that's marked as being able to be deletable, and you see it quickly found all those files. And even though I deleted them, for some reason, it's not showing me here. I wonder if it has something to do with the cipher command I used just a bit ago. Well, let me restore selected file. Let me see if it'll actually recover it. Yeah, apparently the cipher command might have screwed them up. Regardless, I should have recovered it if it hadn't been deleted off the drive by actual overwriting. Let me go back. Once again, live demos can be the bane of my existence. Let me see if the data carving one does any better. Instead, I'm going to do the scan deeper, and what it actually does is it scans down the surface. I can select what file types to search for, and based on the header and footer, extract those files off the system. You still have that running, right?
Right.
Cool. Now, funny, you'd figure the other one would more easily be able to recover the files. I have no idea why it didn't. But you see right now, despite the fact that the F drive, in theory, has nothing on it, I was able to recover all these images and all these documents, which I just had the one. Not that I would ever do this, because this would be morally wrong, but if someone was to, you know, like a very attractive person was to loan you the digital camera, and they thought they deleted the picture off it, and she didn't really delete the picture off of it, someone could theoretically get back her vacation pictures from her time in Rio, but that would be morally wrong, and I would never do such a thing. But anyway, these kind of tools would be capable of doing that. And all it did was basically, instead of going through the hex editor like I did manually, it automated the entire process for me. I can now select this file and just save it. Another thing I can do is instead I could point it at a memory dump of some kind. Like I was mentioning before about hibernation and page file. Well, if I can go over to advanced, I can browse and point it at a file. This can be either an image I acquired using FTK, or it can also be some kind of memory dump along the lines of a page file or the like. Now, this is a page file I had taken off this system earlier. Let me go next. Scan surface. Next. And next. And let's see what pulls off of there. Now, this digger is more designed for pulling up just images, but these are images it found in my page file. If I had a better tool, it might find other interesting things like Word documents or so forth that could be in my page file or in my hibernation file. By the way, you can do very much the same thing with the tool PhotoRec. The reason I'm showing Disk Digger first is it's a lot easier to use. PhotoRec, on the other hand, seems a little bit more full. On if AFT, Data Carvers, Test Disk, Win, there's this little tool called PhotoRec. And it's more command line oriented. I can point it at a drive. I can say what kind of architecture I expect it to be. In this case, just plain old Intel. I can either point it at the file system directly in NTFS, or I can say no partition, just scan the entire device. I can say what kind of file system I'm expecting it to be. And I can say where I want to store the pictures. Also, along the way, I'm going to store it in this folder I'm in currently. I'm going to say yes. Also, along the way, I think I skipped past it. You can say which particular file types you want to try to recover. There are certain ones, like I believe DBF files, it will try to recover, but they look so much like random data, it's hard to know if you're actually getting what you want. Yes?
Well, just kind of, some people may or may not be aware about it, but like the docx files are new as 07 file formats, you can use the zip.
It's just a zip file.
I didn't know about that until like mm-hmm. 2 or 3 months ago.
Actually, I was going to cover that in steganography.
Oh.
All right. You see, it recovered a bunch of files. If I go in here's the files that recovered off my thumb drive. Another nice thing about PhotoRec is if you want to point it at a disk image, you just do it from the command line. You can say PhotoRec space and the name of the file you want to pull from. And you can point it at your page file, you can put it at a DD image, you can point it at a hibernation file or whatnot. No big problem. Let me see, quit that. Oh, yeah, this is the part I skipped by earlier. If I go underneath options, I can go in here and set some things about, see, whether or not I want to let corrupted files get copied, and, let's see, let me quit that one. What I want is file options. I can check off which ones it recovers, and this one, I believe, has a lot more formats it will recover than Disk Digger. 7-zip, DB files, oh, look at all the different extensions. Anyway, there's a ton of ones it recognizes by the headers and footers. If all you want to do is recover your photos that someone accidentally deleted off the flash drive, then Disk Digger is probably enough. If you want to get a little bit more in depth, probably PhotoRec is the one you want. Yeah. And both are free. Actually, I think even PhotoRec might be open source. If you want more information on file carvers, the Forensics Wiki is pretty good. One other note I'd like to make, obviously file encryption makes these file carvers pretty much useless. Because, well, it's not going to have the header and footers, it's going to be random data. Also, I've noticed if you use file compression, which has pretty much existed since what? How long have you been able to compress?
25, 30 years ago.
Yeah, on the operating system. If you do file compression, it makes them a lot less reliable. I believe I took just an NTFS partition, didn't encrypt it at all, just said use compression, and it came back with a lot less data when I used my file covers on it. Okay, so what's writing where? Luckily, I don't need to cover this again. This is that processor monitor, reg from app, and process activity view I showed earlier. These tools are all useful, once again, if you're curious about how forensically sound a device, how forensically sound application is as far as leaving records. These can help you find out where it might be leaving records on a computer. All right, that moves on to Politrix, things that people do that aren't necessarily really all that directly useful. Oh, I mentioned disabling the hibernation file. Let me see, Politrix. Now, some of these tricks might be useful. If you go back to that Julia Mero case and you read some of the testimony given by the expert witness for the prosecution, you get the impression that, all right, in the computer security field, they talk about people called script kiddies. People that run hacking tools but don't know what the hell they're actually doing. They just fire them off and go. Unfortunately, when it comes to computer forensics, there are some people who are like this also. And actually, to some degree, I suppose I am too, because I'm kind of new to some of this. But the person who was on the prosecution side in the Julia Mero case, read the testimony sometime, it's pretty bad.
They call them experts.
Pretty much, just a so-called expert. So some of these Politrix, for those kinds of people, this might actually work. One of the first tools I'm going to mention is TimeStomp. TimeStomp's a little tool. One of the things that forensics analysts do is they look at a system and try to set up a timeline of this happened here, and this happened there, and then this happened later. Well, with tools like TimeStomp, they can totally compromise that. Let me go ahead and jump out to a command line, and I'm going to bring up a couple different things. Let me... Juggling all these different windows gets difficult. In short order. Underneath bin, I should have a photo, a little program called TimeStomp. Alright. What TimeStomp does is, well, multiple things. One thing it would do, the dash V option and the C star dot star, I think it is. Am I doing this wrong? Well, interesting. Well, actually, let's do timestomp dash V. Oh, no spray. That one worked. For some reason, it didn't let me do the star at star. But it shows me when it was last modified, when it was last accessed, when it was last created, and when was the MFT entry modified. By the way, the whole access thing, you may notice in Windows XP, every time you like click on a file pretty much, it changed, updated the access time. Well, there was a registry key for turning that off. In Windows Vista and newer, it's automatically turned off. It doesn't automatically update that. They did that for speed reasons. But you see this particular file was originally modified 8/19/2009. And you notice it was last accessed in 2010. That's because I've been messing with it. I could do much the same thing with, let's look at some other file here. You notice all these files have been modified on 8/19/2009. That was the last time I updated them on the system. Well, let's use Timestamp to mess with them a little bit. And in the slide I showed just a second ago, and if you have it up on your computers, you still see it, I list a couple different options for screwing around with them. One of them is you can set a time on any particular file. I'm going to choose, let's see. Well, let's use the USB D view. USB. And I can set it to just change the modified time or just change last access time. Or I can use the dash Z to do them all. And at that point, I can also say what particular time I want to set it for. I put in a day, and it makes me put in a day. It doesn't actually have to be the day that the event's truly happening. Like, for instance, if Sunday really doesn't fall on that particular day, it doesn't care. You can do it anyway. And I'm going to set it to 2099. Let's see if this works if I didn't screw up the syntax. Oh, and I got to put a time in, unfortunately. 0.300. 0. I hate it when it does that. Oh, I think I see it. This is the reason I wrote the commands down. Unfortunately, the PM is behind my penguin on the slide I have here in front of me. Alright, now notice that this thing is set right here. Last modified, 2099. And if I go to its properties, you see all of its dates are 2099.
Oh, no.
Another feature that they have here is something they refer to as the Craig option. If you, let's see, I think it's the B option. If you, it used to be the Incase had a problem with, showing dates that were the minimum of what Windows would allow you to show. And apparently Windows does too. Notice how it doesn't have a modified date at all?
Hmm.
Apparently I modified this last sometime in the 17th century.
Investigators like it, don't.
Alright, so. And there's a way of setting it for the entire directory. I just don't remember the exact syntax at the top of my head. Maybe that's. Nah. Screw it. I'll look silly on the video later. Regardless, there is a way of making it recursively do the entire directory. Like, I think if I pointed this at a certain directory, like I think I pointed it before at C users, it would actually do that to the entire directory. However, the reason I put this into the politics section is if a forensics investigator starts looking around and sees dates in the 17th century, they know something's up. And I believe they fixed that in Incase since this tool came out. If they see dates in the far-flung future, they know something's screwy then also. So I'm not sure how much it's going to help someone in a legal case. The only time I can think it really would help is if someone sets the time automatically to be like 2 days ahead of time, and then the machine is acquired, and then later on the defense lawyer goes, well, you acquired the machine on such and such date, but it says this file was edited 2 days later. So obviously you all must have screwed up. But then they'd have to hide the timestamp tool. I just see some problems with this actually working in reality. But then again, I've, like I said, never done this in a legal court. So I'm thinking there'll be some complications there. By the way, unfortunately, you can do the Craig option to an entire directory. But if you want to choose an arbitrary date, you can't. But if you use the for command from the command line, like you see at the very bottom here, you can set any arbitrary dates you want on all the files in that directory. Basically, though, I have to throw it into the for command to make it work. Oh, the dash R command does it recursively. That's what I was missing before. I've only played with Timestamp just a little bit. Oh, by the way, this is part of the, Timestamp is part of the Metasploit Anti-Forensics package. They also have a few other tools like Slacker. Slacker will hide stuff in Slack space. The reason I'm not covering it is I'm just not sure how useful it is, and if a tool is, how about this way, if it's less secure than the whole drive encryption and harder to use, I don't see a point in covering it. Because why would you want to go about using that? Another thing that people talk about all the time is alternative data streams. This is something that was implemented since, oh great, it's been in Windows since I think Windows NT 3 something or other. Essentially, it was put in there as a resource for some file systems, like the ones on OS, on Macs, actually have extra information hidden behind the file in resource forks. Well, you can do the same thing in alternative data streams in Windows. Have you ever copied a file and said, if you copy this file, you're going to lose Macintosh volume information? That's because of alternative data streams. And alternative data streams are actually fairly easy to play around with and hide stuff. If, for instance, I'm going to try to use this example right here. If I go underneath my sample data, and let's see. Let's say I want to hide a file behind a file. I'm going to use a type command. The type command is pretty much just like cat is in Linux. To type any old thing. Like, for instance, if I did type file.txt, it typed out the contents to the terminal. I'm going to instead type out, let's see, Adrian Beer, and I'm going to try to, let's see, I think I may have screwed up my slide. I think I left something out that I was supposed to put in there. I don't have the arrow in there. I'm going to hide it behind, if I can. File1.txt, test, and let's see if it worked. Alright, now if I wanted to open that up later on, oh, if I go back in and do a directory, oh, that's not my one at all. You'll notice that file1 didn't change in file size, though I didn't show you what it was before. Trust me, it didn't change in file size. What's that? Yeah, that's even a better way of illustrating it. This is the first time I've presented this particular talk. And unfortunately, all my talks I pretty much present one time. I would assume I would do a little better with them, given enough time. But there, I just opened it up from behind the other file. And I've hidden it, and you don't see it. Well, you see it because I just copied it from one place to another. But essentially, that file is hidden behind another file. Another cool thing you can do with this, if I was to do a data carve, I could still possibly find it. But since it doesn't begin at the beginning of a sector necessarily, it may not easily come up in a data carve. Another cool thing I've done in the past is I've taken an alternative data stream and stuck a TrueCrypt value inside of it. That gets a lot sneakier. But I have a whole article out there at this location if you want to play about alternative data streams. And I talk more about Linux, naughty Linux girls in trouble on that particular article as well. Well worth the read, I suppose, just for that. And like I said, when I use alternative data streams, file carving has been hit or miss with me. If you want to go looking for alternative data streams, inside of bin, I included a tool called Alternative Data Stream View. Let's see, I'm going to point this at desktop, AFT, and where did I put it? Sample data, scan. There's other tools out there. You see it found a few things. For instance, it found that little test alternative data stream. Doesn't tell me what it is, but I now know it's there and I can go look at it. Another thing you notice how some files, when you open them up, it says, this has been downloaded from the internet, are you really sure you want to run it?
Yeah, I hate that.
Well, the reason it's there is, starting at a certain time, Windows started tacking on an alternative data stream, zone identifier, to say that that's what it is. So Windows actually does use alternative data streams for some of the OS functionality nowadays. But you see that right here. That's what that zone identifier bit is.
Well, it is. I mean, I spent 20 minutes downloading and then turn around and ask me if I want to do it. Yeah.
Well, okay, Microsoft had some big security problems back Windows 2000 days and earlier, and even up to Windows XP, that I think they've probably gone a little bit overboard in some cases. All right, that moves us on to steganography. Some people put steganography, I define steganography as hiding stuff in stuff so people can't find your stuff. There's all sorts of ways of doing steganography. Some people equate it to encryption, but encryption is more like you have a big blob of random text someplace, someone knows it's encrypted. You see a big, you know, 10 gig file, nothing but random data. It's an encrypted value. There isn't much else that thing can be. Steganography, though, is meant to hide stuff in plain sight. You see that there's a file there, but you don't know how to get the data you want out of it. You shouldn't even know that the data you want's in there. There's several different ways this can be done. One quick and dirty way is a zip file. Zip files, I'm actually going to actually show this because we're running low on time. Try this command at home sometime, though. And depending on what your unzip utility is, it may or may not work. You copy the dash B there, says go into binary mode. This copies this image to JPEG plus putty.zip or whatever zip file you have together and save it out as test1.jpg. The important stuff in the JPG is in the front of it. The important stuff in the zip file is in the back of it. If you do this, you can sometimes get a JPEG that will work just fine when people double click on it. But if you try opening it up in 7-zip, you'll see it as a zip file and you'll still be able to open the archive, which is pretty nifty. But test that at home sometime. Some zip utilities will work, some will not. Another thing you can do is insertion. How many people here, and you were talking about this a second ago, how many people here know that docx's are essentially zip files? Let me show you this. I think this is nifty. Alright, I'm gonna change my directories. Let's go up into this and where are we at? Sample data. Here we go. Well, that's a little docx. It's a little hard for me to operate with it as it is, so I'm gonna rename it with a zip extension on it, just so it's easier for me to deal with. Alright, now I have a zip file. I open it up. I have a bunch of XML. Now, let's say I wanna put something in there. I can do that. Let me go back to here and let me go to You know what? I really do like the way they did things in XP better in a lot of ways. Guys, it's like this. I'm gonna have to suck it up with Vista eventually, and actually, most of my stuff, my day job, I'm just going straight to Windows 7. Windows 7 does not piss me off nearly as much.
You get used to it.
Let's say I want to hide an exe. Like, I'm going to hide this regjump exe inside of this little zip file I had up a second ago. Alright, I can go ahead and put it in there if I can get them both somewhat side by side so I can drag. And there, it's in there. The problem with me just jumping it in there is that it's going to say it's a corrupted Word doc as soon as I try to open it. So I'm going to copy this out. This little contents type XML has all this information about the other XML files and other files that are in there. What I want to do is I want to go in and tack something else on there. So I'm going to take and copy one of these overrides. And let's see, I believe that one will work. I'm just going to copy it so I have an extra one. And I'm going to go ahead and let's see, what was the directory name? What was the exact name of the program I put in there? Regjump.exe. Okay. I believe if I just call it regjump.exe. And save that out, then put this little contents type XML file back in, copy and replace. Now I think I can get away with this. I've done it before in testing, but once again, live demos are the bane of my freaking existence. It also helps if I had more screen real estate. The video capture doesn't work if I have this thing at a higher resolution, unfortunately. Okay, by the way, is it still recording?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. All right, let's put it back to DocX. Now let's see if I can open it or not if it will complain. It didn't complain about corruption, but if I try to open it back up, let's say I open it up in, let's open it up in Win 7. There it is. Now the one problem with that is if I do any changes in Word and save it out, it gets with a zip file. But another nice thing with this is I can send some body contraband inside of a facility, because they'll accept DocX's past any kind of filtering firewall, but not necessarily EXEs. Now I can't make the EXE execute, but if my point is just to get data in and out, it works. Another thing is a additive type of stenography. Least significant bit. Alright, when you take a JPEG, so certain types of media, that it doesn't matter if you, just slightly off one way or the other. For instance, some people are audiophiles that think they can hear the difference between gold-plated stereo wire and a coat hanger. Usually they really can't, they're full of it. But let's say you have an image. Could you really tell a difference in an image between that red, unless they were just side by side? Or let's say the shades are even closer together. The way it works in least significant bit is they modify the very end, the very least significant bit of the binary data to tack on some extra information. I have a tool inside of, in here someplace, I believe I put it inside a bin, called Vecna. Anybody ever play D&D when they were a kid? Anybody play it when they were an adult?
What was the name of
it? Dungeons and Dragons. I believe they pulled the name Vecna from that. What Vecna allows you to do is encode a message inside of something else. I can, for instance, I can choose something off of my desktop. Let's see. Adrian, where did I put my stuff? Let's go into sample data. Let's take Louisville InfoSec, because I'm proud of that picture. And let me hide in the picture of me drinking beer behind it. Actually, I kind of thought someone who might be interviewing me for a job later on was going to be at today's presentation. So maybe it's kind of good, all things considered. She's not. Anyway. Alright, let me hide the beer one right behind that one. Sample data. Into a passphrase. I'm just going to use test because I don't really care. And image is too small. Let me go with something bigger. Reset. Encode a message. I think this is the base message I have to use. Let me see. AFT. Select sample data. And to see, open file. Well, I know my diploma with PNG is awfully big. I think this is the select image to hide, or it might be inverse. I'm not 100% sure. Sample data, Adrian Beer. Alright, I think it's the reverse. Alright, encode a message. I'm going ahead and point it instead. First one to be Adrian Beer, that's the one I want to hide. I'm going to select the image to hide it inside of. I'm going to point that one at my diploma test. And if that all works, it outputs a file called cdiploma.png. And if I was to go look at that file, all it is let's see. It looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
In reality, it's probably manipulated the colors just ever so bit on a least significant bit where you can't tell that there's a difference.
It's like a $20 bill. $20 bill and then you crown blood one, they're the same.
Something along those lines, I guess.
Yeah.
But I can point it back at that and do the exact thing in opposite, like decode a message, point it at AFT, sample data, C diploma PNG, and let's see, decode that image. Oh, target file, as put it on my desktop. Test dot, I don't know what's going to pull it out as. I'm going to take say JPG, but it may not be a JPG that pulls back out. And I put in the key I used to create it, and it just, hopefully, on the desktop, recovered that image. There's other ways of doing steganography, but that is a couple popular ways. The nice thing about least significant bit ones, if it's done properly, is it doesn't increase the file size. The other ones I showed, it would increase the file size, which is going to be ultimately a dead giveaway that something is up. There's also tools out there. Oh, another thing I've mentioned, and I'm not going to demonstrate it for time's sake, is I always thought about most of the tools out there write with you is all zeros, all ones, or random data. I'm crueler than that. I want to write with something selective. So I thought about, what if I could write my entire drive with lemon toddy? Who here knows what lemon toddy is? Do yourselves a favor, don't ever Google it. Anyway, let's say I take some really disturbing image that no one would want to see. All right, who here knows what Goatsy is? Do you all spend no time on the internet whatsoever?
No, it is. Website.
All right. Those are the kind of images someone could write down the entire drive in a pattern. Then when someone does a forensic wipe later on, or a forensic recovery later on using data covers, they get nothing but the same image a billion times. I came up with a couple ways of possibly doing it. These are not 100% effective. One is to use this script in DD and use this command. Essentially, it just repeats this pattern over and over again and writes it to the drive. Another way of doing it is basically just create a really large file with nothing but that pattern in it on the same drive. And I've created a couple scripts for doing that, and I've just tentatively called it lemon wipe. I'm trying to figure out a better way of doing it. This command actually on the left-hand side has some legitimate uses. If you try to test out how forensically sound your methods are, it might be useful to know what data was written to the drive when it was in a fairly pristine condition. You could use this to write like file one over and over and over and over again. That can be handy to see what if something's wiping in slack space or not, because you'll know what pattern's in it. A lot of different things zero out the drive, but very few things are going to put whatever pattern you choose. So this set of commands can be useful for that. But lemon wipe is not really a good idea from a legal standpoint, because one, you're going to be upsetting the forensics investigator emotionally. not to mention, it's definitely destruction of data. And all these different wiping things I've talked about, if someone wipes the stuff just before a legal investigation happens, you're going to get them on destruction of evidence. Okay, so if they're doing it every week at a certain time, and that's the only time it does it, it's more defensible, and preferably they should have it written in policy that they do it, if it's like a company. That goes back into the whole topic of data retention. So that from that standpoint, it's a bad idea. And lemon wipe, well, it's obviously that someone was wiping it because the only way this would happen where you'd have, you know, those kind of images a billion times down a drive is if someone was to do this. Oh, another neat little trick someone can do, and I didn't bring my drives with me, is I don't know how many of you know this, but if Linux, if you open up a thumb drive, you can add more than one partition on it and make it look like multiple drives. But by default, even up to Windows 7, if you have multiple partitions on a thumb drive, it'll only see the first one when you go into My Computer. You might be able to see it if you go into Computer Management and then Disk Management, but you're only going to see the one. So you can hide data there. That's one potential way. But if someone uses data carving, they'll still be able to find it. This one is somewhat useful. Cloud computing. Essentially, the idea is that you just use your computer as a terminal, and all the actual processing and storage is happening someplace else. Obviously, if the data that someone's looking for is not on the computer itself, then they can't recover it. That's a huge advantage. There's a few problems with it, however. Let's say I use Google Docs. Google's probably fairly likely to roll over on somebody if someone requests the data, especially law enforcement. Also, since it's on someone else's servers, it probably has a lot less protection under the Fourth Amendment. As far as search and seizure, it's probably a lot easier to get Google to say, give me this person's docs, than it is to get a judge to say, allow us to go to this person's home, grab their computer, and copy all this stuff off of it. So if someone wants to try the whole cloud computing technique, they're probably best off trying to find servers that exist outside of the reach of U.S. law enforcement. Some country that doesn't necessarily work well with us. Another thing that some people have suggested is attacking the forensic software. Once again, I'm going to write this up as a bad idea. If someone's forensically, if a forensic investigator is trying to look at a system, pissing them off is probably the last thing a defendant ever wants to do. So, I have an article I wrote on different ways of doing cross-site scripting attacks that don't involve submitting stuff to a web form. Essentially, I think SleuthKit in the past, which is an common open source forensics tool, in the past has had problems with not properly sanitizing input, and you'll be able to do a cross-site scripting attack where you can get your own JavaScript to run in the browser when they look at the evidence. And I covered that a little bit there. There was a group of people from ISEC partners that at DEF CON 15 gave a presentation on a SleuthKit and InCase and various vulnerabilities they found in them. A lot of them were not direct vulnerabilities as in they were able to exploit them, but they were memory corruption errors, which ultimately, if you can figure out how to manipulate it right, maybe they didn't try hard enough, but it points in the error that, yeah, they had some problems. So that was a few years ago. Hopefully they fixed it. Go out to DEF CON site and you can actually download the video of it. Another way people have been known to attack security systems or forensic systems is what's known as a zip bomb. At that URL, I put up a link to something called 42.zip. What it is it's a zip file with like 16 folders in it. And inside each one of those folders, it's like 16 folders. Inside each one of those folders, it's 16 folders. And when you get down to a certain level, each one has a zipped up file that is like 4.5 or 4.3 gigabytes. And they can be able to compress it down that much because the file just contains nothing but zeros or nothing but ones, something that's easy to compress because it's all standard data. But when you extract it all, it takes up 4.5 petabytes. How many people got that on the hard drive? That's another way people have been known to attack. But once again, all these would be bad ideas. Oh, by the way, I want to say once again, I'm not advocating these kind of illegal activities or anything. I just find it interesting the games people play against each other. Between forensics and anti-forensics.
Department of Justice and the DOT got it. We just reported about 3 or 4 weeks ago, but it happened about 2 months ago. Korea, our friends in Korea, North Korea, did it to us.
Hmm.
They passed all the filters and all that and still got us.
With a zip bomb?
Yep.
The zip bomb?
Yep.
Huh. Sure, that's... Okay. Send me a link later. I'll be interested in reading up on that. But anyway, two comments on that. If an examiner sees data attacking him, they know something's up. So why someone was actually trying to cover their tracks would do this, that's just silly, because, like, all right, data's attacking me. Obviously, this person's up with no good. And second of all, it's not really a good idea to piss someone off who's seeking legal action against you. All right. Also, another thing people suggest all the time is Thermite. Like, people talk about, I frequent various hacker forums, and by the way, hacker is neither good nor bad. It depends on who's using the term. It means different things to different people. But a lot of times you also have a lot of teenagers on various hacking forums, and someone's saying, well, you know, I just hook up Thermite above my hard drive, and if someone broke in, I just flip a switch and burn it down. Well, first of all, this is a bad idea. First of all, just know, destruction of evidence charges, definitely. Fire hazard, huge. Not to mention various charges. I'm not sure, is Thermite legal, depending on what you're doing? If
you have to have I don't think you can get legal.
If you make it yourself, well, welders use it. I'm not sure the exact technicalities, but I'm sure they can get you on some extra charges.
Are you talking
charges.
About the thermite that burned the World Trade Center down, that type?
What? No.
Okay.
Sorry, that was jet fuel. Okay. Anyway, continuing on. Besides, it's a whole lot simpler to do full drive encryption. Someone could just go, oh, someone's breaking in? Turn off the power. And wait long enough for that RAM to expire so that they can't do a cold boot attack. What's the point in doing the whole Thermite thing? That said, there's a cool video of people doing a... Oh, while we're on that topic, check out that video later on. I don't have time right now, but I have some, me and my friends doing some data destruction, not with Thermite, but with other types of devices. That moves us on to the final section. Nuke it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. These are techniques that really, if you want to pursue occult computing, is pretty much the way to go. One is, if you're going to wipe a drive, wipe everything. I think I've already showed where it's a bad idea to try to selectively wipe files because things are always moving around. Those temp data RAM put various places, it's hard to know what's what. So it's usually best to wipe the entire drive. You can use DD for that, and you can zero out the entire drive. There's a tool called DBAN, and DBAN is pretty nifty. You boot from it, you tell it to wipe, and it basically wipes down your entire drive. I'm trying to think of the syntax I use on mine, but I actually think I have a video on my website of me using DBAN. It's just super easy to use, and it just overwrites all the data. There's also some other good tools, HDD wipe tool. You might want to try that, and I'm going to explain why in a second. A guy that goes to a lot of the conferences I do, Scott Moulton, was explaining some things to me, and I'm going to cover them in a second. This brings up the whole one wipe with so many ones. It used to be on older types of hardware, like floppy disks and FAT12, there was some possibility if you only wiped once that those remnant data, because in reality, the way stuff is encoded on a hard drive, alright, on a flash media, it really is ones and zeros, more or less. This board sucks. On a hard drive, a spinning hard drive, it's actually more of a wave pattern, and it's encoded in certain ways. On any modern hard drive, if you wipe just once, it ain't getting recovered. If you don't believe me, check out this article. It's got links to more references. Basically, what it comes down to is these people took a magnetic force microscope where they could go down the drive and look at the patterns and pull out the ones and the zeros. Now, here's what they did. The chances of recovering one bit from a drive that's been used for a while is 56%. That may sound good, but keep in mind that random chance is 50%. But let's say it was a pristine drive. The chances of recovering one bit from what it was before was 92%. Hey, that sounds pretty good. 92% of one bit. That's one bit. Probabilities multiply. So let's say to get a whole byte, that's 0.92 to the 8th power. So 51% of getting a whole byte correct on your recovery. 51%, that's not great, but let's take that out a little further. 1 kilobyte. 1 kilobyte might be a letter to your grandmother. Here's your chances. 2.238 to the times 10 to the negative 297th power. It ain't happening. So, I know people are probably going to write me some angry mail saying, no, I know this. I have an uncle, cousin, sister, mother-in-law who works at the NSA, and they tell me you can do this. Well, first of all, if you get investigated by the NSA, you have far bigger problems. But even then, no. All right. That said, there is one disadvantage to using tools like DBAN and DD, is it works through the operating system that it's running from, and by default, it's only going to wipe the sectors that the disk reports to it. Modern hard drives have firmware on them that takes care of marking certain sectors as bad for it and automatically reallocating. It keeps like a G list for knowing of what sectors are bad. And the problem with DBAN is it'll only overwrite the sectors on the disk that the disk reports to it can write to. That's problematic because it's possible that you've had data on the disk at one point in time, a sector has gone bad, the disk itself has marked it bad, but DBAN won't be able to wipe it later. At that point, someone with a decent lab, I suppose, could take apart the drive, look on the bad sectors, and recover 512 bytes at a time off those sectors. That's where Secure Erase comes in. I can learn about this from Scott Moulton. If you ever get to see any of his presentations, they're awesome. He's also going to be speaking at the Louisville InfoSec this year. He does some really cool stuff with drives. But he was talking about a tool that's been built in since like 2001 called Secure Erase, that on the drive level itself, it will wipe out the drive. Not only is it faster than DBAN, if you can get it to work, it also gets remapped sectors. So it wipes that data as well. There's a couple tools for doing that. HD RAM can tell you whether or not Secure Erase is enabled, and there's details at this link for finding out whether or not Secure Erase is enabled on your system. Unfortunately, they don't want malware automatically doing Secure Erase on people's drives for obvious reasons, so many people lock it out in their BIOS. If you want to try doing those erasures, These two tools, I believe, both do it. I know HDD Erase uses the Secure Erase feature. I believe MHDD does as well. Unfortunately, I've had problems with reliability of getting them to work. So I asked Scott what his opinion on it was, and he said, try these tools first, and if they don't work, then go with DBAN. But if after DBAN wipes it, even if someone can take apart the drive and look at the sectors, you really have to have someone more. The average person who's interested in doing identity theft, I don't think would bother. It's just not worth the amount of time for the data they're going to get back. Full drive encryption. There's a couple good tools for doing that. One is BitLocker, which has gotten so much easier in Windows 7. I wish I could demonstrate it, but switching over to this one laptop, after class, if they don't kick us out of here, I'd be glad to show it to people. BitLocker is not too bad. There's some security concerns, but it's built into Windows Vista and newer. Windows Vista, it was kind of a pain in the butt because you had to partition everything ahead of time. Now, they made some tools they released on Microsoft's website to allow you to set aside a little partition, and that partition acts as sort of a first partition that the operating system loads from to be able to decrypt the drive, then load the rest of the operating system from the drive. I don't think I'm using the right terminology there, but regardless, you needed a special partition to start off the whole BitLocker process. In Windows 7, if you didn't create that at startup, it'll create it for you, which is nice. The one problem with Windows 7, if you don't have a TPM module, trusted platform module in your system, you have to go in to gpedit and make this particular tweak. Then you can still use it, but the only way you can use it is with a USB key. And here's the modes of operation for BitLocker. TPM only mode, it stores the key in the trusted platform module. TPM plus PIN plus USB key. That's the best option of all. Basically, you need that physical USB key token to decrypt the hard drive, and you need a PIN you type in, or TPM and USB key. The reason I don't like this as much as the one above is, once again, from a legal standpoint, it's easier for people to demand a physical object than it is something that is in the mind. So even that, it gets legally questionable. Go back and read that Boxer case I mentioned earlier. And then finally, if you don't have a TPM module at all, the only thing you do is from a USB key, but it's a possibility. Another nice thing they built into Windows 7 is something called BitLocker to Go. BitLocker to Go is pretty nifty. What it allows you to do is you stick in a thumb drive, you right click on the drive and say enable BitLocker to Go, and essentially you have to enter a password to be able to decrypt that thumb drive and get data off of it. However, you can unplug that thumb drive, take it to an XP or Vista box, plug it in, and then there's a little exe arm you can run. When you run that exe, it essentially lets you do a read-only copy of the data that was on that encrypted thumb drive. So it's not completely backwards compatible in that sense, but at least you can get the data back off of it. That is a BitLocker. The other option, and I mentioned somewhat before, is TrueCrypt. The advantage of that is open source, so you have more people looking at it. When it comes to encryption, you really want open standards where a lot of people have looked at it. Generally speaking, when people try to invent their own encryption algorithms, or people try to implement their own encryption without a lot of people overlooking things, it's tough to get all the right details in. Another advantage of TrueCrypt is it uses XTS as opposed to CVC. And I'm trying to remember what CVC stands for. Cipher block chaining, yes. Apparently this is better than this, which I've read in multiple places. But I am not a professional cryptographer. You're going to have to talk to someone who knows the math much better than I do to get this to explain to you. I have it on pretty good standing that that is better than that. Also, this will work in XP, which is nice. And you have more cipher options. With BitLocker, I believe it's just using AES. You have several other options with TrueCrypt. And finally, you might also want to look at hard drive encryption. Scott Moulton recommended this particular company to me, so you may want to check it out. They have basically a hardware card you can use to, at the hardware level, encrypt your hard drive, and that would probably also be faster than using software encryption solutions. I also want
want to thank Doubleback for giving me the solution to getting Windows 7 without a TPM to work. Let's see.
Another option I had in mind, but I haven't had enough chance to test it to make sure it's forensically, well, or anti-forensically sound, is to try running a VM, a virtual machine, like a VMware player, out of an encrypted TrueCrypt volume. In that case, it's like the entire drive is encrypted, but I still have my persistence. I don't have to, because sometimes it's nice to be able to make favorites, it's nice to have a history, it's nice to save passwords, but you don't want other people to get to it. But my one problem with that is, while I'm pretty sure all the drive information directly is encrypted, I'm not sure about things leaking out into the swap file. As I showed you before, you can recover some data from the swap file. You obviously don't want that. I asked around some mailing lists on how anti-forensically sound this would be, and no one could really tell me, so I need to do more testing on this. But some suggestions have been made to me. There's two tweaks you will want to do to your VMX file if you're using VMware. If you're using VirtualBox, look for something equivalent. One tweak you can add to your VMX file is memallow auto downscale. You want to turn that to false. A guy named Nicholas on the Paul.com mailing list told me about this one. Essentially, with VMX, especially with VMware, there's ways in which you can give memory back to the host operating system. Well, if it gives memory back to the host operating system and that piece of memory used to belong to the virtual machine, there's a possibility you'll get swapped out to the swap file. You don't want that. So enable that to false. And all this one does is it turns off, by default, at least with VMware Player, it writes out all main memory to a file on the local disk. Now granted, if you're running it from an encrypted volume, this isn't a big problem, but gotta remember, reading an encrypted volume in theory is going to be slower than a non-encrypted volume. So by doing this, you cause it to do less writes than encrypted volume, and makes things faster. I had to use this tweak when I used my netbook, because my netbook has a flash-based drive, and it's a lot slower, at least for continuous access. Without doing this, it was just too slow to run. So those are two tweaks you might want to look into if you decide to try to run a VM from an encrypted volume. But I still need to do some more testing. Oh, other useful tools you might want to know about. Def Linux, which I've used throughout here. FTK Imager and WinHex. WinHex is that hex editor I've been using most of the time. Oh, one thing I do want to show in FTK real quick. Underneath Def Linux, or Def Extra, I have that tool. It's really neat because the several things you can do with it. FTK Imager, bringing it up, I can add an evidence item, either a physical drive or a logical drive. Physical drive is actually at the device level so I can get all the partitions on it, not just C drive, but C drive and all the other partitions that were on that same physical drive. I put it some drive. It'll actually parse out the file system. When this one comes up, you'll actually see that I have like a NTFS, like two NTFS partitions at least, and I think an extended four for my Linux side. But I can go into partition, and I'm trying to remember which one's my NTFS one. This is my NTFS one. And I was mentioning something about copying off this Slack file or copying off locked files. If I was to try to do it just now, it wouldn't work because it was locked. If I was trying to just use my operating system to do it, I could either boot from a CD and try to copy off my page file, or I can do this. I can go find my page file, in this case, pagefile.sys, right-click on it, and say export file. Point someplace, and there I have it. Same thing goes for SAM and system files and registry hives. If you just want to copy those off a system, you can attain protected files and point to where you want to place them, and it'll grab the SAM and system off of running SAM and system hives and other registry hives right off of running system. The reason you want to grab both of those, if you're going to crack people's Windows passwords offline, you need both the SAM and system. The SAM, because it actually has the hashes, and system, because it has the sys key in it. Unless, of course, they've configured sys key to require a USB device. Let's see. And back here. Okay.
That brings me to one of my final topics. How do you know someone has been running anti-forensic software on your computer? Well, there's no 100% it. Let's say you're an investigator, you want to know. I'm interested in helping both sides here because I'm just kind of curious about the whole interplay of how people do this to get around this and these people get around this by doing the opposite. The interplay between the two sides I find fascinating. There's no 100% positive way to know someone's running anti-forensic tools. People used to say you see the entire drive wiped out with zeros, you know. But unfortunately, it could be they just formatted their drive with Vista or newer, because Vista does that now. Or, and I learned this from one of Scott Moulton's talks, apparently some of the better internal flash the solid-state drives will automatically zero data that's not used during part of the like garbage collection cycle. I didn't know about that. I believe he has a video on it you might want to check out, but apparently by themselves, some solid-state drives will automatically do that. Some tools leave behind records that they were ran. For instance, I was trying to show this in S-Delete earlier, and for some reason it wasn't working for me, but this particular registry key, all the sysinternal tools pretty much access a registry key similar to this to say whether or not you've accepted the end-user license agreement. Well, if you go to someone's registry and you see this, you know they've been running S-Delete on the system. I'm pretty sure a lot of these other anti-forensics tools are also doing things like this, but I don't have a complete list of them. I'm never going to have a complete list, but I'm thinking about writing another article that collects a whole bunch of these common footprints. I'm thinking of working on a tool to detect them automatically also. I've covered the whole thing about zeros and random may not necessarily mean that someone's using anti-forensics tools. Another thing you can do is look for hashes of commonly known anti-forensics tools. Like, let's say you have the hash of timestamp. What you can do is you can search down the entire hard drive for that particular hash. For instance, not the right one even. That'll work. I have inside a bin a tool called Hash My Files. I can point it at some directory. Like for instance, this is the hash of this little cookie viewer. I can do a search of my entire hard drive for every place that has that hash. And I could possibly find a piece of file, a file that is that same file but renamed. That could be useful. Also, people use hashes like this. There's actually databases of hashes of known child pornography so that investigators can, and by the way, I'm not trying to help those people out. I'm just saying that this is something that people use as hashes for. There's like records of hashes of known child pornography. So instead of someone actually having to look at the JPEGs themselves, they can look for any file that hashes out to that same value. And unless there's some odd hash collision, they know that person has that particular contraband on the machine. Now that said, it's pretty easy to change the hash of a file. If someone just wants to change the hash of .exe, open it up in a hex editor, change any string in it just a little bit, just keep it the same length, but find a string, make it, instead of saying Microsoft, make it say Inquisoft. As long as you don't change the size of that string, it should work fine, but changing one character in it changes the hash. Now that not necessarily means it's not going to be recognized by like anti-malware, like antivirus and so forth. But those tools like UPX Packer, which will take, its main function is to actually make an EXE smaller. But what it does is it can take an EXE and make it take less space. But in the process of doing that, it's also mangling the form of the EXE, and that will let it bypass some malware detection engines. Who has ever heard of VirusTotal? I think it's virustotal.com. It's basically a site you can upload an EXE to or some other file, and it will tell you on like 20 different antivirus packages what it thinks that file is. So what you can do is you can take an exe, upload it to that, see what it says it is, try these different packers, send it up again, and see if it still detects them. There's a feature of Metasploit called Shikadaganai, which is apparently a Japanese term for there's nothing that can be done about it, that mangles an exe in various ways to try to get it past malware detection. It changes the fingerprint of it. And John Strand, who's also going to be at the upcoming Louisville InfoSec, did a video on using it. There's also something, I'm trying to think what it's called. PEcrypt or those other tools out there for doing much the same thing. Basically, changing EXE around enough where hopefully it's still going to function, but it won't trigger malware detection. All right, I'm pretty much done. I do want to announce a couple events. We have free ISSA classes happening every 2 months. This is one of them. We may not have another one until next year, though, because of the Christmas dinner that's coming up and the Louisville InfoSec. So I'm going to have to be prepping up for those. So we may not have time for the rest of this year to have no one. We have monthly ISSA meetings. They're free for people to come. They don't ask you to join. Well, if you come for like 6 of them in a row, they'll probably eventually ask you to join because you're getting a free lunch. But, you know, you're welcome to come to a few for free to say you're my guest. We also have the Louisville InfoSec coming up. That's our annual conference. I think it's $99 to get in. I have a discount code on my website, though. I think that takes $20 off. And anybody who's interested in being in the CTF, the Capture the Flag event, where we're going to set up a virtual network where y'all can hack it and do a write-up, I got like 7 free passes left to give away. Also, if you're interested in other good InfoSec conferences, check out Freaknik, Nauticon, and Outer Zone. If you're interested in helping with the free classes, I'm always looking for old hardware someone might be interested in donating. As you can see, I have a collection, a hodgepodge of equipment here that, while it's not the best in the world, it gets me what I need. And also let others know about these classes. And also, please send Kelly an email, programs@issakentuckiana.org, and let her know how we can improve the classes. Thanks to Scott Malton, who reviews my slides and was also my advisor on a lot of forensic stuff. Though if there's any mistakes made, it's my fault, not his. Tyler Tripp Richford. Do a Google search for his name online. You'll find tons of videos he's done on Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment rights, where it involves computer security. The folks at BenRev and Paul.com for their advice. Louisville ISSA for letting me use their forum, and John for the extra camera for recording this. Any questions? Sorry, I kind of rushed there towards the end, but I knew we were getting short on time. Any questions about any of the material? All right, in that case, if you are interested in CPE, just make sure you've signed that sheet, and I'm supposed to take that to Kelly, and I guess we're done. Thank you.
It's good.
No problem.
Did a great job.